I'll call to order the Senate Interim Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is Friday, September 14th, 2012, and we are convened for an informational meeting with invited testimony only on several topics of interest. One is MERS and the Court of Appeals decision in NIDA versus GMAC Mortgage. We're going to hear about the administrative rules on mortgage loan servicers, IDIQ price agreements, which we've talked about before, and medical self-referral practices. That being said, Jan, anything that you want to say to tee us all up?
Mr. Chair, I don't have anything to add.
All right. If we could please bring up Fred Boss, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. I have presented today in my written testimony kind of a trust deeds, MERS, NIDA 101. I think my plan is to tee up the conversation and kind of set the stage for the discussion. The written materials is a little more detailed, tells, you know, time periods, days. This, as you may know, is a rather arcane area of law, and we could dive down into weeds for days and days. But I choose not to do that. The Oregon law allows a financing, a real estate financing device called trust deeds. And this is a means by which you, the homeowner, can secure the obligation with the lender on their home. The trust deed has three parties. It is the grantor, which is the homeowner, the beneficiary, which is usually the lender, and then the trustee, which is the person that sells the property. The trust deeds are basically a mortgage, and they're treated like a mortgage. And the only, well, not the only, but a difference, and the biggest difference, is that a trust deed sale or a trust sale is allowed rather than a sheriff sale. It's a more expedient way of foreclosing and disposing of the property. The way in which you foreclose a trust deed is by non-judicial foreclosure, and it's a rather informal process. The trustee files a notice of default and records it with the county. It has such things as just the basic elements: who's the homeowner, the nature of the default, the time and place for sale, those type of basic elements. They also serve upon the homeowner a notice of sale, which is basically has the same information. New in 2012, as a result of Senate Bill 1552, there is for trust deeds and for lenders that deal with a large amount of loans, there is a mediation program in which they are to participate with the homeowners, and as required for a trust non-judicial foreclosure is what's called a certificate of compliance, that they have participated in to some degree in this mediation program. Also, there, as a result of Senate Bill 1552, there cannot be a foreclosure if the homeowner is in compliance with a foreclosure avoidance measure or the lender is considering a foreclosure avoidance measure. And what are foreclosure avoidance measures? That's like a deed in lieu of foreclosure where the homeowner just gives up and submits the deed and walks away and their foreclosure process is not gone through. There are short sales and loan modifications. This addresses a problem that was occurring called the dual track issue, in which homeowners would thought that they were proceeding forward on, say, a loan modification, when in fact they were proceeding on forward with a loan modification and a foreclosure, and they were foreclosed when they thought they were working on a loan modification. That can't occur as a result of Senate Bill 1552. One of the other issues that we'll address today is something called MERS. And MERS is the Mortgage Electronic Registration System. That is a corporation that manages a private electronic database that tracks transfers of interest on loan obligations. It is designated as either the beneficiary or the mortgagee on between 50 to 60% of the loans throughout the nation. It was established in 1993 by the mortgage industry. It's a way in which transfers of loans can happen without the recording process. It saved the cost of recording. It also enabled the industry, working with the securities industry, to package together loans, which would essentially be mortgage-backed securities. So you've probably heard about the mortgage-backed security market that boomed and is now busting. And this MERS system enabled that to happen. That's a background for the discussion of the NYDE versus GMAC mortgage decision. That's a Court of Appeals decision. And the facts, what happened was that a homeowner was going through the foreclosure process of a trust deed. The only way, since it is not a court proceeding, the way to get the defense or the issues forward in a non-judicial foreclosure is to file a court action to enjoin the proceeding forward of the foreclosure. This homeowner did that, and at the trial court level, the lender moved for a summary judgment, saying everything is in order, and the trial court granted that summary judgment. It then went up to our Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals looked at the situation, and in this particular case, the beneficiary under the trust deed was MERS. It wasn't the lender. It was MERS, which is the way that many of these trust deeds and mortgages operate. They put the trustee the beneficiary is MERS, so that trades can happen, or transfers or assignments can happen of the ownership interest, and it will be essentially this corporation that is the beneficiary. The Court of Appeals looked at that situation and said, well, the beneficiary should be not MERS. Well, the beneficiary needs to be not only the person that is named on the trust deed as beneficiary, but also the actual person to whom the money is owed. And they found in this situation, I believe, at least as far as the summary judgment was concerned, that MERS was not the person to whom the money was owed. They also said that in looking at the Oregon Trust Deed Act, the act requires that any assignments of this beneficial interest be recorded. And as I talked about with MERS, what the MERS system is a private electronic database that does not engage in the county recording system, and so transfers do happen, and essentially trades of these assignments and sales of this beneficial interest happen, but they're not recorded usually. In this case, the court found that there was some evidence that there was an assignment of the beneficial interest, and that beneficial interest had not been recorded. So the Court of Appeals reversed the lower court's decision. The Court of Appeals did not say that MERS was illegal or anything like that, but the impact of this decision could be very great, because many mortgages and trust deeds do have MERS stated as a beneficiary, and they do have assignments that are not recorded. So this is a Court of Appeals decision. I assume that it will be appealed to the Supreme Court of Oregon, so we kind of have an intermediate court decision. There is a similar issue has been presented from a federal case and has been certified over to the Oregon Supreme Court in the Hooker versus Northwest Trustee. And so at some point, the Oregon Supreme Court will address this issue. Why is it important? Well, if you can imagine, there have been a lot of non-judicial foreclosures for the past, I don't know how many years, And the question, are these all void? Are they voidable? The impact of this could be tremendous. One of the impacts that we're seeing is that lenders are hesitant now to use the non-judicial foreclosure method. And by conversations with lenders, they are considering the judicial foreclosure method. A trust deed can be foreclosed both non-judicially, which is a more expedient manner, or judicially. And the judicial foreclosure method is just like any lawsuit. The lender files a lawsuit with a complaint stating the allegations of ownership and a default on the note. The homeowner can come in and file an answer with any defenses that they may have, such as statute of limitation or payment of the note or whatever. And then it's litigated. It's usually disposed of in a summary manner by either default or by a summary judgment, but it's litigated in the courts. That does have an impact on the court system if the foreclosures that are out there turn from a non-judicial informal method into a judicial method, so that they'll be taking up court time. The lender, if you proceed forward in this litigation, the lender has a burden of proof, which is different than in a non-judicial foreclosure. There is a different sale process in a non-judicial foreclosure. There is a sale by the trustee, which is, again, a rather informal process. In a judicial foreclosure, there is a sheriff sale, so the sheriff will advertise and there will be an open and obvious sheriff sale. There is also what's called the right to redeem in a non-judicial or in a judicial foreclosure, so that the homeowner can come back and either to the lender at a certain point in time or to the ultimate purchaser within 6 months. Pay the value, pay what the purchaser paid for the property, and get the property back. That certainly, if you are the lender or the purchaser, that's not probably the best deal in the world because you have some uncertainty there, and that certainly is an issue. We have seen an impact of this decision already in our mediation program, or in the mediation program set up by Senate Bill 1552. We were anticipating it was, as you recall from my prior testimony, the Senate Bill 1552 mandated for certain types of lenders that they participate in a mediation program under certain circumstances. We had anticipated hundreds, if not thousands, of homeowners and lenders participating in this mediation program, and it's been about 20. So I think what has happened is that what we hear has happened from the lenders is that they're reluctant to participate in, reluctant to go down the path of a non-judicial foreclosure because of the uncertainty here, and they are considering going the judicial foreclosure process. That wraps up my overview. I have in a lot more detail in the written materials, but I'd be happy to either answer questions now or cede the floor to the other panelists.
Senator Boquist.
Looking forward, question here. Federal statute, federal court, you file in federal court, you know, Diane and I argue we file against each other. It doesn't matter what we filed against each other for in federal court. The judge says, okay, first thing is go prove to me you've tried to mediate this. We have no such mechanism in state court, which boggles up the state court the way it is right now. Were such a mechanism in place under the judiciary and the judicial laws that if you filed civil action, that mediation was one of the options, the judge could immediately say, hey, go try and mediate this so you don't clog up my courtroom. Since we don't have that mechanism in state court at this particular time, if one was in place, do you see the present mediation system that we have as a viable option for judges to order them to do that rather than clog up the courts?
Chair Shields, Senator Broquist. The answer is a qualified yes. The statute 1552 specifically states that this is, the mediation system that we've established is for non-judicial foreclosures. So there would, you would need a statutory change in order to make it available for judicial foreclosures as well. With that statutory change, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Rizma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fred, my understanding is there are a number of other states that only have judicial foreclosure. I mean, that basically you have to go through that process in order to issue a foreclosure. Do you know if a number of those states do have what Senator Boquist just suggested, an ability for court-ordered mediation as part of that process?
Chair Shields, Senator Rosenblum. Yes, they do. I believe some of the other panelists will be able to speak in much more detail than I can.
Great, thanks.
Just a follow-up comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Boquist.
And I think not just in issues of mediation that we're talking to, because we have our courts are clogged so much right now at the state level, and of course the federal side has picked up this issue of saying, okay, first go out and try and prove to us you try to mediate this before you clog up our court system. I think even across the board, and Senator Brzezinski would probably agree, we're a little behind in our court system here in Oregon because it is clogged up, and that might be one of those applications across the board in all civil complaints that might help free up court space and might help free up state dollars.
Thank you. One question for you, Fred. Can the right of redemption be negotiated away?
Chair Shields, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I could look that up and get you that information.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't believe so, but I feel uncomfortable just saying yes or no.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Pilar French, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Shields. Thank you, committee members. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I have done a PowerPoint here, and I've provided you with some written materials. The reason why I did this is I think this is a complicated area of the law. It's an intersection with property law, with laws pertaining to lending, with private contracts, and with the use of agents. So the purpose of this PowerPoint, and I think I could, it takes me a little bit longer to walk through it than 20 minutes, but I provided it to you so that you can look at it, because I was trying to boil this down and kind of simplify the issues for you from a legal standpoint. First thing I want to say is, who am I? I don't regularly come down here and testify. I am an attorney that's been living in Oregon since 1996. I started my practice at the Department of Justice. I spent a year working in the financial fraud department, but I left there in 1999 to go work at Lane Powell, which is a private law firm. When I went there, I sometimes represented plaintiffs. I sometimes represented defendants. Primarily, if I was involved in a lending issue, I would represent lenders, because that's who my firm represents, and there are ethical obligations that we have not to take adverse positions. So I've been doing lending law since I've been at Lane Powell, and since before it really became an issue. I saw this go through the crash. Before the crash happened, I had probably a running caseload of 30 cases. Now I have a running caseload of 190 cases, just at any given time. I've had to hire a lot of people to handle them, and all I am doing is litigation involving lending, and primarily mortgages. I do and have represented MERS. I've represented Bank of America and Wells Fargo, and I'm just telling you that for purposes of disclosing that to you, because you need to know who I am to understand what my point of view is. What is MERS? I think that Mr. Boss described it pretty well. Yes, MERS is a private corporation. It provides an electronic database, an internet-based database, so that loan servicers and investors can track loans together. There are a lot of agents involved in lending, and there always have been. There always has been a secondary market, at least in the last several decades. Fannie Mae has been around since 1938. With due respect to Mr. Boss, mortgage-backed securities existed before the advent of MERS. MERS was created in 1993. And so far as I'm aware, securitization was occurring in the 60s and 70s. So this has been around for a while. Why do we do that? When you sell a loan, if you're a lender and you make a loan and you can sell the note to somebody else who doesn't have a problem waiting for the payments to be remade, you get the cash and you can make another loan. So what it does is it promotes credit liquidity. That's why lenders do that. MERS, in part, was created to save transaction costs. If MERS can, and the way it works is you have MERS serve as an agent capacity as the beneficiary under a trust deed, or if you're in a mortgage state where it's a mortgage, they're the mortgagee. They serve in that capacity for the lender and any successors or assigns. What does this eliminate? It eliminates paperwork so that each time that note is sold, that underlying promissory note is sold, MERS will continue to be the beneficiary of record in the land county records, and until that loan is paid off or if there needs to be a foreclosure, then an assignment of the trust deed occurs by MERS to whomever is going to conduct the foreclosure. I've heard some arguments that, well, wait a second, this is depriving county recorders of fees by doing it this way. Well, you have to think about something pretty carefully, and it requires somebody to do some math. If you start requiring every time an assignment of trust deed to be recorded, every time the note is transferred, you have to ask yourselves if you have enough people on staff that can do that, or do you have to hire more people that will be doing that in the county recorder's offices, and will it be something that is profitable for each of those counties? I don't know the answer to that. That's something that you need to think about. But if you increase fees, think about it this way. You increase fees, you're increasing the cost of lending. Ultimately, that's going to be borne out by consumers who are going to have to pay more for their loans. So the way I look at this, I think consumer protection is really important. But we have to look at this globally and consider whether this is right for all of Oregon consumers, because it will impact the cost of lending. The MERS system reduced paperwork. That's a transaction cost that's off the books. MERS also could reconvey title if a lender went out of business. You may recall the savings and loans crisis. That created a problem for a lot of folks that had lenders that went out of business. They couldn't get their titles clear if they wanted to refinance or have their loan paid off. So we come to how this affects Oregon. This litigation started in 2010. So think about it. For many years, MERS was functioning and operating as a part of our real estate lending system before all of this litigation started. The litigation started because of the mortgage crisis. Borrowers started trying to come up with ways to figure out how to stop foreclosures, and this is an argument that they came up with, and thereafter hundreds of lawsuits followed. I think that Mr. Boss analyzed the issues. There's two primary challenges that are laid out. The first is that the borrowers say that MERS cannot be a beneficiary, as that term is defined under the Oregon Trust Deed Act. Lenders claim, yes, MERS can be. We use agents all the time in these transactions, and there's nothing in the law that says that a lender and a borrower can't agree to have an agent serve as the beneficiary under a trustee. The second argument, I've put in here some more detail for you, but I'm not going to go through that. The second argument, it has to do with 86735, which outlines the conditions for conducting foreclosure. One of the conditions is that all assignments by the beneficiary must be recorded. Lenders say, well, MERS records the various assignments. It is the beneficiary, even if the underlying note is sold, it stays as the beneficiary. And when it assigns the trustee, that is all that is required, because that's what the trust deed says. That's what the parties agreed to in order to get the loan. Now, borrowers say, nope, that's not right, because there's this common law principle. It's been around for hundreds of years, which says that the security, the trust deed, follows the note. So each time that note is transferred, that trust deed goes with it. Now, the funny thing about that is if you look at the seminal case, which is a United States Supreme Court case decided in 1872, what the court said is that the trustee follows the, or the security follows the debt unless the parties agree otherwise, which means that you can contract around this. The two parties to the private contract can reach an agreement on what's going to happen with the security. So the lender's argument is that that's lawful. But our courts are divided. They have been sorely divided. Judge Aiken threw up her hands in April and said, I'm going to certify all these questions to the Oregon Supreme Court. This is, case was actually not the Hooker case. I think Mr. Boss misspoke. It's the Brandrup case. Hooker is still in the Ninth Circuit, and I'm on that case. They have not certified any questions, and so far as I'm aware, and I believe Ms. Harpster can confirm, she's on that case as well. But then there's Nade. Nade was issued on July 18th, and Nade adopts the borrower's claims. It says MERS can't be the beneficiary, and every time that note is sold, there has to be something recorded in the land county records. The day after that, that opinion was issued, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the certified questions in the Brandrup case. There's going to be a hearing on January 8th about that, but we don't know when the court will reach a decision on Brandrup. So for now, Nade is binding law on all of our trial courts. The federal courts have discretion about whether to follow that, but I suspect that they likely will. And so Nade controls this. What does Nade mean? Nade means that MERS can't be the beneficiary, and that you got to record every transfer of the promissory note, not the trust deed, which is what the Act says, but the promissory note. Obviously, borrowers who are in default like this ruling. That helps them. Lenders and MERS disagree with the ruling. And as much as Nade sought to solve some problems, it's created a lot of questions, and I'm pleased to hear that Mr. Boss agrees with me. There's a lot of stuff left to be litigated, so lawyers that work in this area, they're going to be busy on both sides. Can MERS be an agent? Under Nade, we don't know that. Judge Simon in federal court says MERS can be an agent and can sign documents on behalf of the lender and record documents on behalf of the lender. I don't know if that, you know, that's going to be litigation. Nade doesn't address equitable defenses. Like, you know, sometimes in court you can say, well, look, can the borrower ever have any hope of repaying this debt? If not, there's some equities to be examined. We have to go through a summary judgment, which is expensive, to get to that question. We have to put evidence on about that. What do we do with servicers? Sometimes servicers, under Oregon law, they serve as the beneficiary. NADE seems to contradict that. Completed foreclosures. Lenders thought they were doing it the right way. NADE says they're not. So borrowers, counsel, are now bringing lawsuits, and I've had a lot of them come into my office in the last week saying that a foreclosure that was completed, and maybe even the property was already sold to a third-party beneficiary, was void. What do we do with that? We can argue that, no, it's not void, but I don't know what the answer is. You see a change over here. There's some statistics. In June, people were still using non-judicial foreclosure as a remedy. In August, it's pretty much trickled down to a standstill. There were 31 non-judicial foreclosures filed in August as opposed to 492 in June. You also see an uptick in the filing of notices of lease pendants, which are what you have to file before you commence a judicial foreclosure. So there is movement. NADE, just to be candid, it basically renders the Oregon Trust Deed Act a nullity. You cannot use it if you are a lender. I will tell you that most loans are sold on the secondary market, whether you have a local credit union making the loan, whether you use a community bank, or whether you use one of the big banks. They're all sold on the secondary market. There are 415,000 MERS loans in this state. We cannot try to go use the mediation program if we have a MERS loan. I can't recommend that to a client because it could be a void or voidable agreement. There's no finality to that agreement. I might get in trouble for trying to contract around the Oregon Trust Deed Act. I can't recommend that to lenders to do that. I have read articles in the newspaper suggesting that they're sour grapes or something to that effect, why lenders aren't using non-judicial foreclosure or the mediation program. It is not that. It is this ruling with some problems in Senate Bill 1552 it's just completely not user-friendly. Nobody wants to buy more litigation. If you're going to do a foreclosure, the person that buys that property needs to have finality. They need to know that they're going to be able to move into that house and it's going to be their property so that they can make improvements, so that they can fix it up. They can't do that with the state of the law here unless they do judicial foreclosure. Title insurers don't want to provide title insurance on non-judicial foreclosure. If you can't have the insurance, you can't use this process. There also may become questions about who's going to start paying the property taxes on these loans that are in default. Lenders usually pick that up, but I don't know. We shouldn't expect them to do that when they can't foreclose on the security. Maybe this will be solved for you. Maybe Brandrup will decide this, but I don't know. This slide talks about why they're going to do judicial foreclosure. This is a consumer protection issue. It's a small business issue, and it's very important for our economy. Yes, we do need to have some remedies and reliefs for borrowers who are in distress, and I think that there have been substantial strides made in that direction, but we're not there yet to make it a workable program under Senate Bill 1552. And if we don't fix the Trust Deed Act here to make it so that agents can serve as beneficiaries, the option is going to be to use the judicial foreclosure remedy. That is more expensive. That's going to increase costs of lending. There is the redemption period. And in answer to your question, Senator Shields, yes, you can negotiate a settlement to quitclaim over your redemption rights, and that helps. And I have done that in some cases. It's kind of a cash for keys theory, okay? We know that you're not going to be able to redeem, but maybe we can get you some moving money and help you pay for your first and last month's rent. There are options, and that is one of them. But unless that redemption period is waived, the property sits vacant. And we, you all probably saw the mayor's notice yesterday about dealing with vacant properties. Vacant properties are a problem. You can't improve but if you're the new owner, but you have to avoid waste. So what do? You board up the property for 6 months. It causes a blight in the neighborhood.
Ms. French, couldn't you also argue that this whole case really gives the lenders an incentive to move into the short sale process and get this process going and to the table in a much quicker fashion?
You can argue that, and I hear that argument a lot. And I'll tell you, I try to negotiate and settle these cases as much as I can, but sometimes the borrowers are in such financial straits that there's no possible workout that can be done because of a job loss or what have you, but yet they don't want to give up that house. And so, you know, yes, we can try to negotiate, and we do. And we try to work with the Department of Justice and be good corporate citizens. I believe in that. I think that's important. If you cut businesses off at the knees so they can't function, that is not good consumer protection, because we need lending. We need lending for small businesses. We need lending to improve homes. We can't employ that construction contractor that we want to employ to fix up something if we can't get a loan unless we have cash. That means that that construction contractor loses a job. It's just vital. Credit liquidity is very tied in to all of this. And yes, there does need to be a balance. There does need to be a balance. The Oregonian described NIDEA as a victory for homeowners. I don't agree with that. I think it's a victory for borrowers who are in default, but it's going to undoubtedly increase the cost of lending, and that's going to impact people who are paying their mortgages. That's going to impact people who need or want to sell their homes but can't because the home value is depressed. It's going to affect people who want to get loans but can't get them. It could lead to a decrease in the availability of loans and making home loans more affordable for everybody because the transaction costs will go up. Legislative solutions, if you're asking me, I think you need to fix this. You may not want to. It may not be what you want to hear. It may not be what your constituents want to hear. But if you don't, judicial foreclosure is the option, and yeah, we can try to mediate those too. But at the end of the day, if we can't come up with a workable solution, we can't be giving everybody a free house. If you do that, then what do you say to the people that are working three jobs to make sure that they pay their bills? I mean, you have to strike a balance, and I don't envy you because you have a difficult challenge ahead of you. I appreciate your time, and if there's any questions.
Senator Boquist.
I appreciate you coming down. And it's not often that we get a real person to come down here. Instead, we get all the lobby that's out there. And and I was with a bunch of business leaders very recently, and they said sometimes the lobby that they even pay doesn't represent them either. And there's always two sides to every coin, as you know. But I have a question on beneficiary.
Yes.
And since you're not a lobbyist and you're actually a real human being trying to work on this as a lawyer, whether you're on the opposing side than I am, I suppose, the banks would say. But I have a question about future beneficiaries. And if you follow the train of thoughts, and I'll give you a few tidbits here to enhance your next presentation. Ginnie Mae started in 1968. That's the government-backed, and that's when they did the first securitizations and the mortgage-backed securities were bundled together. And, of course, it was followed by Freddie Mac in 71, Fannie Mae in 81, and then in the infinite wisdom besides yesterday, which is where we're going with the beneficiary question, the Federal Reserve in 1983 decided it was a good idea to put all this stuff in one big pot. Starting yesterday, we're now going to buy $45 billion. The Federal Reserve is going to buy $45 billion in mortgage-backed securities per month to bail the system out. And just to Diane, my good colleague on the left, Bush got us into this. Bush, too, got us into this. Clinton got us into this, and Obama got us into this biggest mess. But now the question on beneficiary comes down to deal is, if the Federal Reserve is buying these mortgage-backed securities at $45 billion per month, which means consumers paying for it, which is a whole lot more than the problems we have in Oregon, when they go to foreclose on one of these houses that's in these in the mortgage-backed security, who's going to be the beneficiary? Is the Federal Reserve going to be the beneficiary now since they're buying the securities? Do you have any grasp of how that might work? And I don't know the answer to the question.
Chairman Shields, Senator Boquist, I think that under the day, yep, they're the beneficiary.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. French, isn't one of the reasons why judicial foreclosure is also attractive in that you know going in that a large number of people will not actually show up in court?
In judicial foreclosure? Chairman Shields, I don't necessarily agree with that. There's so much litigation, I have no reason to believe that judicial foreclosure isn't going to be just as hot a topic of litigation as non-judicial foreclosure was. But the reality is that many borrowers do want to move on. They do want to just do some sort of cash for keys and move on if they realize they can't satisfy the obligations on the loan. And that does not change whether you use one remedy over the other. But they do have to get sued if you use judicial foreclosure. And I have plaintiff's attorneys that I work with that don't like that. They want me to do a non-judicial foreclosure, but I can't if it's a MERS loan.
So have you done some judicial foreclosures since the NetAid decision?
Working on them. I'm working on them. It's, I know that our housing market, we've seen an uptick in the value, but that's probably because this is halted. And what lenders are doing is they're trying to work on changing the process over to do judicial foreclosure, which traditionally is not used in this state.
And you haven't had any court dates since?
I have some active matters that are in judicial foreclosure and many that are set to be filed.
And of those where there actually has been a court date, what percentage would you say did the defendant not show?
I haven't had any that don't involve uncontested judicial foreclosures, but please understand that my law firm doesn't traditionally do judicial foreclosures. There are other firms in town that have more experience with that. This is new to us, too. We're having to learn how to do this because this is the remedy for lenders who need to recover the debt because of a default.
And so what you're arguing is it's not the fact that NetAid requires you to record the assignments in the court that's the problem with judicial foreclosure. It's the ambiguity around who the agent is. That's what you're arguing?
It's the inability to get any finality. I can't recommend to a client, go ahead and use non-judicial foreclosure, but note that a year down the road, that foreclosure may be declared void. I can't recommend that.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum had a question. And Senator Boquist, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to move on. But
I just need to make a point of clarification. My math was wrong. It's $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities with mythical money and $45 billion in treasuries with mythical money.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. French, I think you mentioned that Bank of America was one of your clients. And last month in August, they held one of those come-one, come-all forums at the convention center that they've been doing periodically for homeowners that are in trouble to be able to sit down with the lender and try to work something out. So I guess I was curious if this whole, if this decision has thrown everything topsy-turvy, how is it that the lender is still able to participate in a process that looks pretty much like the mediation that we set up, but without the mediator? If the ownership of the property is so in question, they still seemingly are able to work out mortgage modifications or other kinds of changes.
Chairman Shields, Senator Rosenbaum, the question is not about who owns the loan. That information can be discerned, and I have never had a lawsuit about a fight over who owns the loan and really have there be merit to that, or the claim of I don't know who to work with. You work with the loan servicer, which is Bank of America or Wells Fargo. That's who the borrower always pays. That's who the borrower interfaces with. That is the entity that is charged with managing the function of the loan. It's never been Fannie or Freddie or one of the investors that supplies the funding for the loan. You work with the mortgage servicer. So the mortgage servicer is still in a position to negotiate a loan modification. There's no question about ownership. The problem is if you have a note that's been transferred multiple times or you have a MERS loan, you can't use a non-judicial foreclosure remedy if it's determined that the borrower just, you can't work it out. You have to use judicial foreclosure. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, thanks.
Thank you,
Ms. French. We appreciate you coming to testify.
Thank you for your time.
Could we please bring up Kelly Harpster? Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. All right. Thank you. Good morning, Senators, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Kelly Harpster, and I'm an attorney in private practice in Lake Oswego. My background is in real estate and business litigation, but for the last couple of years, foreclosure issues have occupied substantially all of my time. I represent borrowers. I work with attorneys who are struggling to understand some of the issues in their own cases. I've worked with advocates on legislative proposals. I talk about these issues. For the last year, I've spent a lot of my time on our new foreclosure mediation program. I served on the Attorney General Work Group that helped develop some of the rules and the forms for the program. I then got a chance to travel around the state training our new foreclosure mediators, and then to go around and train some of our new housing counselors, who are just an amazing group if you haven't met them. And then I now serve on the current advisory committee for the program. So I want to talk to you a little bit more about NIDA. You've gotten some kind of technical overviews. And the thing I want you to know about NIDA, I mean, you've sort of heard the basics and you've heard the lender's view, but what I want you to know about NIDA is that, in fact, it's sort of unremarkable. It's a great opinion, but it's unremarkable in the sense that it essentially just confirms longstanding principles of Oregon law. It doesn't do something new. And I think that's important for you to know. What it did is very concisely and elegantly and persuasively reconcile about 100 years of common law with the plain language of the Trust Deed Act. And that provides clarity, but it also was a very effective way to just explain the law. Frankly, most of the mediators we trained could now read that decision and understand it. Now, what they did, and I don't think anyone's quoted it yet, they had a little rhetorical flourish at the end to summarize what the holding of NIDA was. So the last sentence is sort of the most quotable, so you should hear it because everybody else does. And what they said is, a beneficiary that uses MERS to avoid publicly recording assignments of a trust deed cannot avail itself of a nonjudicial foreclosure process that requires that very thing, publicly recorded assignments. So it makes a certain amount of sense. I don't think anybody said exactly what the specific two holdings are. That the lender, not MERS, is the beneficiary because the lender is the person for whose benefit the trust deed is given. And that any assignments of the trust deed, even if they have occurred by operation of law, have to be publicly recorded to commence a nonjudicial foreclosure. So that's what the case actually says. Now, this first point about lender being the beneficiary is actually not that difficult to understand. One of the great things about attorneys is that sometimes we're very good at bringing confusion where there is clarity. We get paid to do that sometimes. And I think we've, on both sides, been very effective at taking these issues and making them seem incredibly complex, which does keep us in business, so I'm not complaining about that. But it's not that difficult to understand. So here's what I want you to know about that. The Trust Deed Act, since 1959, when it was first enacted, has always defined beneficiary as the person for whose benefit the trust deed is given. And what is the benefit of a trust deed? Well, the benefit of a trust deed is it secures to the lender the payments under the note. So if the borrower stops making their payments, if they default, then the lender can foreclose that trust deed and collect the proceeds of the sale to pay that debt to the lender. That's all it is. Just like if you don't pay your car loan, they can repo your car to pay the loan. Now, MERS, they're not a lender. They don't make loans. They're not parties to these promissory notes. They are not even legally entitled to enforce the notes under the Uniform Commercial Code. And if you were to look at a MERS trust deed, and some of you may have them at home and not know it, if you were to read one, it says expressly in the trust deed that it secures to the lender payments under the note. That's what it's for. So given these facts, it's not really that surprising that the Court of Appeal said the lender and not MERS is the beneficiary of the trust deed, because the lender is the person for whose benefit the trust deed is given. Now, there is an argument, and Ms. French touched on it today, that MERS has also made on this issue that's important to understand, and that's about being an agent. And what it really boils down to is this. The borrower entered into a contract with the lender, and the trust deed is part of that contract, and it calls MERS the beneficiary, and the borrower agreed to that, and that's true. And so MERS says, well, then MERS is the beneficiary because that's what the parties agreed, or at least the court should treat it that way. And here's the answer to that in a sort of colloquial way, right? All of you could agree to call me Einstein, but that doesn't make me a genius, unfortunately. And all of you could agree to call me a chicken, but I still can't lay an egg. So what the court basically said is, you can agree to call MERS a beneficiary, but that doesn't mean MERS can meet the statutory definition. And that's the problem with the argument. And so that's how the court reached its decision. Now, the second holding is actually the one that's causing more problems. It's this problem of assignments. But again, it's really not that difficult when you think about it. What the Court of Appeals did is to say that any assignment, that language in the statute, really means any assignment. So the Trust Deed Act has, again, always, it's never changed since the beginning, required public recording of any assignment of the trust deed by the beneficiary. And that's a statutory language. And the Court of Appeals basically said any means every, all, each one of. So, again, this is not deep legal thinking. This is consult your Webster's Dictionary. So we've known that. But MERS has also strenuously argued that not all assignments are assignments for purposes of the Trust Deed Act, so that some assignments don't count. And the problem they've run up against is about 100 years of law that says differently. And it's really the problem that Ms. French talked about, this mortgage follows the note rule. And it's always been the rule. So since at least the mid-1800s, Oregon courts have consistently held that the mortgage follows the note. And what that really means is that where you have a mortgage note, a secured promissory note, that is assigned or negotiated to another party, it carries with it an automatic assignment of the trust deed or the mortgage. And that's a very good rule. It doesn't protect borrowers. It protects our lenders so they don't lose their lien just because they forgot to get a separate written assignment. That's why we have the rule. And as Ms. French pointed out, it's not just the rule in every state, but even the United States Supreme Court going back to the 1800s has said that's the rule. So it's a good rule. Now, it's important to remember that even though that's always been the rule, it was the rule in 1959, at least for 100 years in Oregon, when the Trust Deed Act was enacted, and well before MERS was created in the 1990s. But it doesn't cause them to lose their liens. Just because they don't have the paperwork, they don't lose the right to foreclose. They just don't have what they need to move forward with the nonjudicial foreclosure. So what 9A really does is, when I say it's unremarkable, what I mean is it is just confirming that Oregon law is what it has always been. That's the key point. Now, the court is there to interpret the law. So the court's tasked with figuring out what the law is. But as a legislative body, you make the law. You decide what the law should be. So your questions are a little different. And so it is fair for you to ask, why should we require publicly recorded assignments? And Ms. French has asked you that, essentially. And the answer is, for the same reason that in judicial foreclosures, we require the foreclosing party to prove that it is a person entitled to enforce the note. We require them to establish that they are the right party to foreclose, prevent abuse. And so if you are a third-party purchaser in a nonjudicial foreclosure, where by default there is no judge to show the evidence to, there is no way to establish this, the only way that you can know that this stranger beneficiary, who's not mentioned in the original transaction, they're not in the trust deed, they're not in the note, you as the purchaser don't know who they are. The only way for you to know that this person has authority to order the sale of the property and collect the proceeds is to look at those land records and see the assignments. In fact, what those recorded assignments do is tell you, they publicly establish, in the same way you would in court, for everyone to see that the trustee really does have the authority to sell the property and to convey good title to that property. Now, there's a case that all of us cite all the time at both sides, and that's a case called Staffordshire. And what it talked about is that the Oregon Trust Deed Act really is a balancing act. And it is. It's a delicate balancing act. And it allows us to give lenders the opportunity to take people's homes when they don't pay without any judicial oversight. And that's good. It's an efficient process. But it's a balancing act. If you yank out this piece of the act, you have now fatally upset that balance if you just remove that requirement. And so there's nothing to prevent abuse. So that's the problem. Now, Ms. French touched on this thing about the assignments they don't have. I get asked all the time, well, why don't the banks just record the assignments? And it's not that they're just being stubborn. In many cases, they simply can't comply. As Ms. French mentioned, most loans today are sold almost immediately onto the secondary market. They are sold several times, there's multiple transfers, and they end up in a trust where they end up with one of the GSEs, typically. And if you were to look at the governing documents for these loans, what you would see is they typically say that the seller, if they're using the MERS system to track the loan, isn't required to turn over a complete recordable chain of assignments. So that's why lenders haven't gotten them. That's what they've agreed. Now, you will also see that if they're not using the MERS system, they usually are supposed to turn over these documents, but there's substantial evidence that during the housing boom, lenders took a lot of shortcuts in the process, particularly where paperwork's concerned, so they still don't have them. And if some of the folks up the chain don't exist anymore, and we saw a lot of banks fail, then they just can't get them. And even if they could get them, I suspect that in many cases they would decide it's just not worth the time and the expense of recreating that chain now just to avoid a judicial foreclosure. So that would be a reasonable business decision. But again, they don't lose their lien. They don't lose their right to foreclose. They simply have to foreclose by a different method, a method that allows them to prove they have the right to foreclose. So they have to use other evidence. So this other point that's come up about an impact of 90 is, well, it means a shift to judicial foreclosures, and I think it's been suggested to you that that's bad for borrowers, that that's a bad thing. And the answer is, it is unequivocally not bad for borrowers. It's a good thing for borrowers. And here's why. First of all, it is not, I think, Senator Rosenblum, you asked about this. Judicial foreclosures are the primary method, or in a few cases, the preferred method of foreclosure in 25 states. So half the states, this is all they know. So this isn't some new or foreign or ancient process. In fact, in Oregon until 1959, we were a judicial foreclosure state, so just a few decades ago. And even since then, we have always had judicial foreclosures. They just weren't the primary method of foreclosing. So it's nothing new. But what judicial foreclosures bring is judicial oversight. And if you've been watching the headlines for the last 3 years, almost daily, there have been reports of widespread illegal foreclosure practices. This is what has borrowers so upset. This is what led to our foreclosure settlement. So the fact is, at least during this time, having judges ensure that the foreclosure process is proceeding in a legal fashion is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. Here's another thing judicial foreclosures bring is sheriff sales. Instead of the wholly owned subsidiary of the bank that's foreclosing on you, selling the property, it's the sheriff. And so for a lot of borrowers, that's a much more comfortable position. And I can tell you that we have seen complaints not just from borrowers, but from purchasers about questionable and sometimes illegal practices by the trustees. So having truly neutral third parties oversee this foreclosure process is a benefit. It's not a burden. There are also some practical advantages. There's been this suggestion that borrowers aren't going to be able to function in this new system. If they have to defend these cases, it's not going to be fair. Borrowers aren't going to be able to represent themselves. Well, here's the reality. You need to understand how it works today. If you are a borrower and you have a wrongful foreclosure pending and you want to challenge it, you're going to have to pay a lot of money to an attorney because they know there's going to be a lot of motion practice at the start. It's very expensive. So a lot of them decide to go it alone. You have to figure out, as a self-represented borrower today, how to draft a complaint that is going to survive a motion to dismiss from an attorney like Ms. French, who is an expert in the issues, an expert in court procedure, and an expert in the law. If you survive that and you figure out how to get it served and you pay those fees, to get your sales stopped, you still have to get a temporary restraining order and you have to figure out how to get a preliminary injunction. You're going to have to go through an evidentiary hearing. And you, the borrower, are going to have to prove that the lender doesn't have the right to foreclose. And even if you get that, you're going to have to pay a bond to keep the injunction in place. In a judicial foreclosure, the borrower just has to file an answer. The lender has to prove that it has the right to foreclose, and there is no sale date set until the judge is satisfied with the evidence. So from a borrower perspective, this is actually an improvement. And I throw in a bit of trivia there. When our statute, the Oregon Trustee Act, was first passed, it actually had a provision that allowed borrowers to choose judicial foreclosure. They could veto the lender's decision. Lenders hated that and immediately took it out. It was always seen as a consumer protection provision. Now, we've talked a little bit about completed sales, and I think there was a suggestion sort of the world's coming to end. We have all of these sales that have happened. And I guess what I want you to say, know about that is that, yes, we've had a lot of sales, but the banks have fully understood going into this what the issues are and what the risk is of moving forward without these assignments. And they have proceeded anyway. These are very sophisticated entities that know how to measure their risk, and they have assumed that risk. They have been hoping that the courts, or frankly the legislature, would go back and say, well, all of these foreclosures that already occurred are now legal. And that's at the expense of homeowners. The legislature really shouldn't be providing after-the-fact title insurance to lenders at the expense of homeowners. But if there is a time, and I think Ms. French suggested this as well, if there is a time where we need to have that conversation about whether we really need certainty for completed sales, it's not yet. Because the Oregon Supreme Court hears oral argument in January. They haven't decided. And while I think, like Ms. French, that they are going to say the same thing as NYDA, they certainly could say something differently, and you will have fixed a problem that may never have existed in the first place. So I think you should give the courts time to act. But if we need to have that conversation, you would want a targeted solution that really solves the problem but doesn't just throw people out of their homes. And the one other thing I wanted to bring up, and I've been aware of this, but I think you should take this into account as you consider going forward what you ought to do. NYDA seems to be clear. Ms. French understands it. I understand it. I think you now understand it. And yet, we have thousands of pending nonjudicial foreclosures in Oregon that don't comply with the law. And the scope of this problem only became clear to me in the last few days. Recon Trust, which is the wholly owned subsidiary of Bank of America and handles many of their foreclosures, if you go to their website, you'll see 1,200 pending nonjudicial foreclosures still moving forward. I've had calls in the last few weeks from not only borrowers but attorneys and housing counselors who are having trouble getting these sales stopped. One of the housing counselors, Bank of America, told them that they don't consider that NYDA impacts pending sales. They're moving forward. Borrowers should not have to hire attorneys to stop these sales at this point. Northwest Trustee Services, if you go to their website, you'll see 3,200 pending sales in Oregon, and this is a problem. So what this tells me is that these very sophisticated entities are moving forward knowing there could be lawsuits on these completed sales. They have measured their risk, and they have either found it negligible or tolerable. And that's the business decision they've made. And we're asking borrowers, and we have, and fairly so, to suffer the consequences of their choices. But I think you also have to ask banks to suffer the consequences of their own knowing choices. So if you have, I do want to address quickly, I know I'm probably running a little long here. There were a couple of questions that came up, and let me just circle back. Senator Boquist, I think you asked, can judges order people to mediation without a statutory change? And the answer is no. There is a process under ORS 36, sort of civil cases. Judges can refer parties to mediation, to a court annex mediation, but if either party objects, they don't have to go. And the judges don't, it's not clear that judges without any rule change could just send them to the mediation program the state set up. That's not a court annexed mediation program. I think we addressed your question, Senator Rosenblum, about other states having judicial foreclosure mediations. It's a very common process in other states. Maryland, New York, Florida had them for a while, but it's very common. It started in judicial foreclosure states and has been very effective in those states, the mediation process. There was also, Senator Boquist, you asked a question about this new program of buying up money and who owns it. And Ms. French actually, I think, misspoke there. So the Fed would not be the beneficiary, and here's why. They're buying up securities. They're buying up the actual bonds. They're not buying the loans. The individual investors don't own the loans. The trusts do. And so the Fed would not be the investor. The trust would be, whatever trust it is they're buying securities from.
Senator Boquist and then Senator Dingfelder, we're going to have to move on.
Okay, so the Federal Reserve buys the mortgage-backed security, which, of course, is securitized based on MERS. For those who don't know, that's how it's securitized, which is, of course, up in the air, whatever this means. So then if they buy this note, you know, this security, then who can foreclose? They own the security. How does that work? Who foreclose?
So when these loans are securitized, when they're placed in the trust owns the loan. So whether or not I believe they're buying agency securities. So in that case, the trustee of the trust is going to be the agency. It's going to be Fannie or Freddie. But they're in a trust. So they don't own them for their own books at that point. And so they sell essentially bonds, the right to earn interest and to get a kind of payout on this, right? So you get a guaranteed return. But the individual investors don't own the loans. The trust does. Those are assets of the trust that generate an income stream to pay the investors. So the trust, or in this case it will be the GSEs acting as the trustee, they're going to be able to foreclose, and they'll do that through their servicer. They always have, and Oregon law allows that. 86A.175 specifically says a servicer can either hold an instrument and foreclose in its own name on behalf of the investor. So that's okay.
Clear as mud.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you for your comments, and I appreciate the dueling attorney perspective, but the question is, where does this leave the consumers in Oregon? And understandably, we are here to try to figure out how to move forward with this. My main concern is that, you know, the consumers are the ones that are really being impacted here, and so I'd like to hear your perspective, especially on the timing for judicial versus non-judicial remedies for, you know, just the time frame, and if you can talk a little bit about other states and how long it takes to go through the judicial process versus what we've been doing here in the New York.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question on judicial foreclosures. It actually may turn out to be more beneficial to borrowers than this, and this isn't the ideal way to get there, and I'll admit that. But the reality is in other states where they've had judicial foreclosures, where they've bogged down, I mean, that's what's one possibility, right? The courts, if enough are contested, they could bog down. Now, that's a lot of ifs. It's if enough are contested. And even in Florida, I think they were reporting, even when they were sort of in the news and the robo-signing and everything was big news in Florida, it was still only around 2%, 3% of folks contested the foreclosure, so relatively low. But their courts simply couldn't keep up. They had a huge volume, well beyond anything we have here just in the numbers of foreclosures. And what that means is it takes longer to complete the process. That's actually additional time from a borrower's perspective to sell the property if you have equity. If you don't have equity, to do a short sale, so you can still try to complete a short sale, because you still have title in a judicial foreclosure until the redemption period ends. So you got a very long period. So the truth is, borrowers may actually have more time to negotiate a graceful exit. So on timelines, again, I don't think that's prejudicial to borrowers. I think the biggest negative consequence, and I don't consider it a consequence of 9A directly, but indirectly so, is the fact that our mediation program, which offers a tremendous opportunity not just to avoid litigation, which it does, and I think that's good. I don't think borrowers should have to bring lawsuits to get modifications. But to avoid the scammers, which have absolutely plagued the state, especially coming out of California and other places, and DOJ is doing everything it can, but it's a hard problem to solve. I would say 85% of the folks that call me have already been scammed in some fashion. They turned over money that they could have used to cure their default or for relocation costs to somebody who promised them hope but was really scamming them. Mediation gets them out of the hands of the scammers, from my perspective. It also means they don't have to run off to a lawyer and pay a big fat retainer and a monthly fee. It's just the really hard way to get to, I want to find out, do I qualify for a modification? The program gets them to housing counselors who know the stuff inside and out, who provide services regardless of your income. They're highly trained. They're great advocates. They know the stuff better than any attorney in the entire state, and I say that without qualification. So the program itself is fabulous. But unfortunately, the consequences we've seen in non-judicial foreclosures, and we never contemplated, funneling judicial foreclosures into the program. And I think we need to rethink that piece of it. But I think that's the best thing we can do for consumers.
Thank you.
And in closing, Ms. Harpster, could you just tell us your background and qualifications as an attorney, where you've worked previously, et cetera?
Well, actually, ironically, kind of like Ms. French, she started out as a clerk at DOJ, kind of on the consumer side, and now represents Bank of America and the others. I started out at Davis Wright Tremaine, which does a lot of the contested cases also for B of A, contested foreclosure cases, and SunTrust. And so I started out there and ended up on the consumer side. So we're sort of swapping places. But yes, I have, I've been representing borrowers for the last several years doing this. My background is in real estate litigation in any case, but have worked extensively on these issues for the last couple of years.
Well, I think we all know that Davis Wright Tremaine will hire anybody, so.
Maybe not now.
Sorry, John DiLorenzo, I just had to get that plug. Thank you very much, Ms. Harpster, for your testimony. We're now going to jump into the next topic, the administrative rules on mortgage loan servicers, and anything that you gentlemen can do to help us get back on track time-wise would be much appreciated. Could we please bring up Fred Boss?
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, just a comment because you'd raised up scammers. For once, I'll do a kudo to the banks or point out to the banks. We have all these scammers trying to screw over the consumers across the board, and unfortunately, the consumer is blaming the bank in many times and the servicers because they get screwed over by these scammers. And, so the banks and the servicers are getting a bit kind of a bad rap because of the scammers, and there's probably more we ought to be doing against the scammers. And as you well know, most of the banks don't like me, so I think it's unusual that I say something good about them. So
you're not alone. Mr. Boss, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I'm Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to talk about our mortgage or our servicer rules. I think we can't really talk about those servicer rules without talking about the national mortgage settlement. I also understand the time limitation, so I will be brief. Starting at the end of 2011, we started working on the, in conjunction with the 50 other states and the United States government, working on a mortgage settlement with the top five servicers: Bank of America, Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, and GMAC. So through the end of 11 and this year, we have negotiated essentially a nationwide settlement agreement with those top five servicers. Ultimately, we did end up with a settlement that was effective in April and will actually be truly enforced or into fruition in October of this year. Ultimately, 49 states, excluding Oklahoma, signed on to the settlement agreement. In addition to all of the state, 49 state banking regulators and the federal Department of Justice and federal banking regulators. So we have this this large settlement that addressed basically a nationwide problem of mortgage servicers and the issues that homeowners were having with their servicers. The servicers were to pay $25 billion to the various entities. $20 billion of that was relief to homeowners. Oregon received $29.3 million in cash to assist in the crisis. We also will receive $30 million, up to $30 million in benefits. These benefits are loan modifications, short sales, things that the banks were to negotiate with the homeowners directly, not through any state entity. There is, as part of this nationwide settlement, a monitor, and the monitor is monitoring the progress of the states and the progress of the servicers towards their goals. They were to expand that amount of money, the $20 billion. It wasn't something that they were to sit on and wait for the homeowner to come to them. They were supposed to be making outreach efforts to the homeowners. In the first 3 months of the settlement, 1,630 Oregon borrowers have received $98 million of relief. This relief is completed loan modifications, forbearance agreements, short sales, refinances. So the nationwide settlement agreement is actually working. It's working for Oregonians. Part of the, in addition, this on the monitoring, Oregon is a participant in the monitoring. There is a monitor who is the Banking Commissioner of North Carolina. He reports to an advisory committee of 12 states. Oregon is one of the states on the advisory committee. The as a result or as part of that settlement agreement, there were mortgage servicer rules, and they're extremely detailed. I think they're about 40 pages in length, and they deal with certain almost a regulatory system to address the problems that were addressing that were coming up with homeowners, such as the dual track issue. They establish a single point of contact. Homeowners quite often wouldn't know who to call. They would get conflicting information from the banks. There were, like I said, about the dual track issues, making sure that there was correct application of payments. So we had very detailed regulations. While we were negotiating and working on the nationwide settlement agreement, we looked at having our own mortgage servicer rules in place. So in February, the Department of Justice, under the authority granted to it under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, issued temporary rules to address what we saw as the servicer issues here in our state. And they address certain problems such as misrepresentation. They require the banks to work in good faith with their consumers or their customers and address about, I think it's 10 points that I've provided to you. We wanted something to have in place because we didn't know at that time whether or not the nationwide settlement was in fact going to happen and what would be the result of that. Ultimately, the nationwide settlement did happen. We, in proposing permanent rules, proposed rules that were very similar to the mortgage servicer rules in the nationwide settlement. We, as required by statute, we had public hearings, we received comments on those rules, and what we heard was a concern that the nationwide rules, or those detailed rules, which were about 20 pages in length, had an adverse impact on credit unions and the smaller consumer, the smaller banks, the community banks, and that they, while they may be appropriate for Bank of America, they may not be appropriate for small community lenders. They had reporting requirements and things like that that may not only may be not cost effective for a smaller organization. We heard those comments, and we decided to, as the term was ending for the temporary rules, to make our temporary rules permanent. And we went through the process, and they are permanent. The in the hearings, we also heard suggestions for some modification of those temporary rules. But we actually did not, in the hearing process, the focus of the energy and all the comments was on the rules that we were prescribing or offering, which were the detailed rules, the ones that were about 20 pages in length. What we've decided is to reopen and to go back seeking amendments to our temporary, what our temporary rules that became permanent, and to actually have hearings on those particular rules. We don't know whether either side, either the banking industry or the consumer folks, had a chance to comment on the rules that actually became permanent. And so we are about to embark on another round of hearings to hear what sort of modifications and the comments that people have on our servicer rules. So I think that is actually, that's a status report on the servicer rules, and be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Fred, if you could name three things that are different from what loan servicers have to do today versus what they had to do before the rule adoption, what would they be?
Well, there is a specific requirement of good faith, which I don't believe was actually in the it may have been assumed, but it was not delineated. There is talking about a prohibition of misrepresentation as far as information concerning the loan modification, so that would address again the dual track issue. Although it wasn't permitted, it was a practice that we have seen to charge late fees that may not have been truly required by the paperwork, so that there's a specific prohibition against that.
Okay. Questions? All right. And more details are part of the packet, which will be on the web for people. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Everything will be on the website.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Paul Cosgrove for the Oregon Bankers Association, Independent Community Banks of Oregon, and Oregon Financial Services Association. Paul, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you mentioned, I'm Paul Cosgrove representing those entities. And because people have been stating their credentials, I thought in addition to being a lobbyist, I'm proud to, President of Capcom, I'm proud to be a lobbyist. I've also been an attorney lobbyist in private practice who has worked in real estate and represented lenders, trustees, and occasionally borrowers for over 30 years. I represented many of the people through the 1980 crash. My office has done literally hundreds, if not thousands, of non-judicial and judicial foreclosures. So I have actually practiced in this field actively as an attorney, and so I make my comments with that background. What I was assuming the chair would like to hear is, from our perspective, is what's happened with respect to servicing rules that is specific to Oregon. I will mention briefly the national settlement because I'm going to talk about a chronology. Prior to 2012, it isn't as if we didn't have rules about servicing. One, all state licensed lenders had a variety of both statutory and regulatory requirements that affected how they made, serviced, and dealt with defaults of real estate and other loans. federally chartered institutions also had those. More importantly, and we've talked a lot about MERS and NIDA, the bigger issue here in Oregon is Fannie and Freddie, because roughly 75%, we don't have actually specific figures for Oregon, but nationally, roughly 70 to 75% of all home loans are owned by Fannie, Freddie, or Ginnie Mae. And those are all done by assignments, and in almost all cases, those assignments are not recorded as well. So one of the things, I won't talk about NIDA except to bring to you that issue. It's not just a MERS issue. If you take that theory to the next step, it's a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae issue. And it's also a commercial law issue because we do participations, including with our treasurer, with banks, where those participatory agreements where pieces of loans are assigned and sold and tranches of credit are also not having, if they involve real estate, assigned trust deeds. So before that, we had, before 2012, Fannie and Freddie had lots and lots of rules about all the loans they were willing to buy. And as I say, that's the majority of home loans here. The last time I checked, the Fannie Mae servicing regs were about 1,000 pages, and servicing deals for everywhere from closing to collecting payments. In a small percentage, roughly about 5% at this point in Oregon, there are defaults, so it deals with default issues and, if necessary, foreclosure. They always deal with short sales and deeds in lieu and all of those alternatives as well. They change frequently. They publish an annual compilation. The compilation is dated as of September. It usually comes out in January, February. And between last September and this January, February, when they published, they'd made 13 additional changes to the servicing rules. So it's a frequently moving target about what the owners of 75% of Oregon loans are asking servicers to do. But those are, in fact, servicer rules, obviously, that they have to comply with, and they pre-exist what we did in 2012. So what happened in 2012? Mr. Boss didn't mention that there are actually two sets of temporary rules that were issued by our former Attorney General, one in January that clearly had significant problems, constitutional problems. It was done without consultation, to the best of our knowledge, with any affected party or any advocate, and was almost immediately withdrawn a couple of weeks later. Then there was the February rules, which, of course, under all Oregon temporary rules, can only last 180 days. We didn't hear anything more from the Attorney General's office until May or June. And the reason we weren't surprised about not hearing about permanent rules is because in between there, as Mr. Boss said, in comes the national settlement. And the temporary rules were intended, in our understanding of the conversations we'd had with the parties, to be something that preceded the national settlement but would be supplanted by the national settlement. And the national settlement has hundreds of pages of requirements, but 42 specific pages on default, foreclosure, deeds in lieu, short sales, those kinds of matters. So they're pretty comprehensive and pretty detailed. As Mr. Boss said, they were effective in April. They weren't going to be fully implemented till October because all the attorney generals recognized it takes time to change processes. And what Mr. Boss didn't mention, and this is a big issue in terms of our concerns with what happened next, is that they have standards of meeting those rules that do not require perfection. In other words, the monitor is to look at certain things. There's a 1% error rate permitted, certain things a 5%, and certain things a 10%. This is what was negotiated between the lenders and the 49 attorney generals and the United States government. What happened next in May or June, when we were not expecting it, is we got another set of proposed rules from the former Attorney General's office. And this is what Mr. Boss said generated all the negative comments. It was intended to apply essentially all those federal standards from the Big Five, if I can use that shorthand, the Big Five banks he mentioned, to all Oregon lenders with absolutely no error rate permitted. And, in effect, a private right of action if there were errors, including errors that were not knowing errors, but just mistakes, and even minor mistakes, because they're very comprehensive and they require lots of things. Not surprisingly, Oregon lenders, especially small lenders, had problems with that. Big lenders had problems with that because, in fact, the proposed rules were sometimes inconsistent with the ones they just agreed to with the feds. That was obviously a problem. And they also codified certain provisions that would have made them eventually be inconsistent with what Fannie and Freddie required them to do, and they're contractually obligated to do that. So lots of problems with those rules, and we appreciate the fact that the new Attorney General recognized those, read, I had a meeting with her, and she assured me she had read every single one of the comment letters, both pro and con, and I believe she did, in detail. She had a full understanding of the issues, and she decided we weren't ready for that kind of thing with the kind of impact it might have on Oregon small lenders. So those were set aside, and in fact, she took the rules that were adopted in February as temporary rules and made them permanent rules. The chair has asked Mr. Boss about whether they require banks or credit unions or any other kind of lenders to do anything other than the law otherwise requires. And in my view, not much. And the reason I say that is they require lenders to comply with federal law. They require and specify those. They require lenders to comply with their own contracts, which they are legally obligated to do. They require lenders not to misrepresent, which is a violation of common law misrepresentation. And they require lenders to do good faith and fair dealing, which is an implied covenant in every single contract, whether stated or not, in the state of Oregon. It's a matter of common law. All contracts, parties have a good faith and fair dealing covenant implied. What they do, however, is they provide another way for litigation to occur, because a violation now, in addition to whatever remedies there were under the contract or under federal law, and there's always remedies under one or both of those, this had another layer of remedies, another layer of litigation, and that is Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So in my view, that's what the current rules do. Then I want to add one other thing that I think is pretty important for you to know. Last month, under Dodd-Frank, a new bureau was set up in the federal government, and Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, if I can be permitted to use the initials, has published what it proposes as its servicing rules effective to all lenders across the country. They are very detailed. I frankly haven't studied them. They're based on the Truth in Lending Act, and there's a 177-page rule packet under that act, and then they have a second rulemaking under RESPA, the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, another piece of federal legislation. And I believe, I didn't write down the exact figure of pages, it's somewhere between 150 and 200 pages there. They intend those to be commented on by the public, typical federal rulemaking, over these next few months, and their schedule is those will be adopted either in that form or some other amended form by January. So I've mentioned two things that are national, the national settlement in April with the Big Five and the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau proposal, which is still pending. But all the rest of those rulemakings, of course, on servicing are locally. We create them. They're Oregon-specific. Then came 1552, which had a number of changes. You've heard about mediation. The problem I think most lenders are having have to do with the non-mediation changes made in 1552, which are highly problematic, more so than the mediation changes. And then came NIDA. So what we have, and NIDA is a very specific Oregon decision. This is, MERS issue is not an issue in most other states. In nearly any other state, the MERS system is considered appropriate. Washington just had a decision that just said MERS can't be the person who files the nonjudicial foreclosure, but all that means is they have to assign it back to the lender, as Ms. Pilar French said is the normal practice. So it's really not a difference in Washington. This is a very specific Oregon decision. It has, not surprisingly, thrown a wrench into the whole system. And I guess one of the reasons that I would suggest to you that we ought to care about that is there is more and more research. The latest came out and was published yesterday in a publication called Housing Wire. This is from the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, but there's also a study by, it's either the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which, that takes a look at when we have lengthened out, and that's clearly what we've done here, a foreclosure process, is that good for delinquent borrowers, and is it good for everybody else who's not delinquent? And the conclusions of those researchers based on economic analysis is no, it's not necessarily good for either of them. And stretching out the time often means more costs and more turmoil for the delinquent borrowers. It may mean they get to stay in their house longer. It may not, because you don't stay in your house during a redemption period. That's the issue of vacant properties that was mentioned previously. But it most certainly likely costs more to borrowers and lenders. And, in fact, it has a cost to the housing market recovery as a whole. And the data on that is becoming clearer and clearer that in those states, New York is probably the worst that I'm aware of. It's nearly a two-year process in New York. Florida was approaching that timeline. We've just moved our non-judicial process from 4 months to 6 months, plus litigation, and our judicial process could be as short as 3 months or as long as however long a court might take to make decisions, so it's sort of an unknown time period. But clearly, we have lengthened our process. So that's the reason why we're concerned about what has happened here in Oregon and think there need to be some changes. I'm happy to talk about whatever, of course, you wish. I just wanted to mention one other thing in terms of a question. It was Senator Boquist mentioned it, although you heard his answer. We have not only state voluntary mediation in our courts. We also have mandatory arbitration in our courts. It currently only applies to cases where the amount of controversy is less than $50,000. That's been around for a very, very long time. So our courts already have both mediation, although it's not the same as the Attorney General's process, and arbitration available in civil cases. Right. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Paul, for your point of view. Questions? All right. Thank you for keeping your testimony short so that we can get back on track.
Mr. Chairman, I just forgot to mention one other thing in response to a question, if I may, and it was Senator Rosemount. There are mediation programs that work. The one to the north of us in Washington works. It took 14 months, if I recall, or 14 sessions of a work group to work through the details and two sessions of the legislature to get it right. It functions well, and people are using non-judicial foreclosure in Washington. We based our program on Nevada. Nevada doesn't work. And that is the basic problem in 1552 with respect to mediation, is we picked a program that, in fact, has been shown to be one that doesn't work very well.
Okay.
So
we'll thank
give you
for that
the
last
courtesy.
Word.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate your point of view. We will now go into the IDIQ price agreements for architectural and engineering services. My understanding is that Lori Sentenspiel from the Oregon School Boards Association provided some written documentation, but is unable to be here to present that, so we will just put that into the record. Could we please bring up Scott Winkles of the League of Oregon Cities?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the 242 cities that comprise the League of Oregon Cities. As I had indicated in my testimony on this topic in a previous hearing, the use of IDIQs, although we call them something different in city world, is not, I would say, wildly popular among city governments. We do have some cities that use them, and I do have some two lists, Beaverton and Salem, who use this process to procure A&E services and engineering services as well for smaller projects where an RFP isn't necessarily warranted. I would draw your attention to the first page, the document page, Consultants of Record Utilization Report. This is the City of Salem. And one of the things I'm going to note here is that in every category, with the exception of electrical engineering, the top-ranked contractor and the contractor where most of that business went was an Oregon-based company or had a significant Oregon presence. OBEC is the Bridge Engineering. That's the largest. That was one of the largest contractors. That is a Salem-based company. OTAC, the second place finisher, is actually is a publicly traded international company that received a very small amount of money in these from this contract. Additionally, the Geo and Technical Services, the Geo Engineers Inc. That's two Oregon offices. The second place finisher, also an Oregon company, they did get some work out of that contract. I think when talking to the project to the Public Works Community Development Director for the City of Salem, I think one thing that they would do differently in their process next time is not issue allow so many companies on the eligibility list for project management. I think when they issue what Salem does is every 5 years they issue an RFP. And they competitively rank the companies that come in. And then for that 5 years, they'll draw off those contracts. I think based on the previous 5 years, having six, seven companies on a list made sense. However, this contract started in 2008. And so when the economy crashed, for lack of a better word, clearly the work went down. So I think that's something that they would probably choose to do differently in the future, is maybe allow fewer companies on the list to create that expectation. I would also add that throughout the process, the cities let the companies know there is no guarantee of work, and it's very difficult to project small projects over a five-year time frame. But I think they've done an excellent job, given the financial situation, of making sure that those public dollars are being cycled through the Oregon economy. I would also add, sitting through other public contracting work groups in this building, particularly the one Senator Byers, Representative Holvey, Representative Wisnett are leading on the CMGC process, is that there's a general theme, and that is there's not enough work to go around. And I think there are some concerns. I think one of the ways to make some of the concerns go away is to fully recapitalize the Special Public Works Fund. I mean, I think we know what the scenario looks like when we don't have enough money in this SPFW. Maybe we could try an experiment and see what happens if we fully capitalize that fund and see if there's more contentment within the contracting community.
Is that the completion? Ready for questions? Or were you pausing because you thought I had one?
I'm good, Senator.
Okay. So this document then is of which municipalities?
That is Salem. The second one is Beaverton's. Okay. And I apologize. We had one of the challenges, again, everybody calls us something else. We have consultants of record. We have a proposed service retainer lists. So we were having a hard time getting the data that you had requested for communication reasons. I would also say that Beaverton's similar. I haven't done the complete analysis, but it looks like the majority of the work on transportation, utility, contract, and technical support and services have gone to Oregon-based companies or companies with a significant Oregon presence.
Janet, and is this document available in the back for people with...
I don't know. Did you bring extra?
I brought to 25 as required.
I think it looks like it back there. So if people who are testifying want to take a look, do we have any sense of how many of these are minority women or emerging small businesses?
Chair Shields, Salem didn't currently track that for this list. They're starting to when they're just entering in this process again. They just started the new 5-year window, and they're participating in some federal transportation projects where they will be tracking that.
Okay. Senator Dinkfelder.
Thank you. Well, having actually my former employer is not on this list, which I'm sort of surprised, but having worked through this process we used to call these on-call contracts. I mean, my experience is, first of all, most of these companies actually are national or multinational companies. Part of that is some of these companies, like CH Tomb Hill, started out, my former employer, as an Oregon-based company, but many of them have gone national. They've been purchased by other – there's been a lot of consolidation on the market. And my experience has been that most of the – minority or women-owned firms are subs to these larger companies, and that's how they fulfill their contractual, their requirements with cities, and especially on the federal level. The other is that because of the shortage of public funding, I mean, there's been a lot of competition for very small amounts of federal, state, and local dollars. And so certainly I totally agree with you. You know, one of the areas I think we can recapitalize is state revolving loan fund for water, which is certainly something that I've been working on, because a lot of these large both water and sewer infrastructure projects could create a lot of jobs. We tend to focus on transportation, but certainly for small municipalities, and water and sewer projects are a huge chunk of their O&M costs. And so I think we miss a huge opportunity in the state by not looking at ways to capitalize those projects as well. And certainly if you have any comments on it, I appreciate it.
Chair Shields, Senator Dingfelder, you're very correct. You talk to an economic development director in a city, and when they're looking at an employer, one of the most common things that comes up is water, wastewater. And that's, I think, you know, I think one of the things that's hindering our economic growth is our ability to deal with to provide those basic services. You know, you look at the microchip manufacturing, very water intensive. The agricultural industry, very water processing industry, very water intensive. And so the ability to meet those needs is doesn't just provide those construction jobs in the short term. It actually provides the economic environment we need to create jobs in this state. And I would also add that City of Springfield uses these processes as well. I did not include their list because they haven't issued any work, because they don't. It's not for a lack of want. It's not for a lack of projects that need doing. It's for a lack of money to do them.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Thanks, Scott. I do think that one comment I would like to make, to the degree that the cities are paying extra attention to this over the next 6 months to make sure that there is equal opportunity for emerging small businesses, minorities, and women firms, I think that would help us get to a point where we wouldn't have to take this on legislatively. So if you could send that message back, we'd appreciate it.
If I may, Chair Shields, one of the things we're tracking, we simply don't have enough contracts or enough time to get a trend line, is to see how the QBS requirements are going to impact that, as if the legislative imposed QBS requirements going to impact our ability to meet those, what the legislature has also directed us to do, is to promote minorities, emerging small businesses. Again, we just don't have, there aren't enough contracts on the books or enough time with that statute in place where I think we can get a good trend line. But that's something we will definitely be looking at as well.
Yeah, well, the engineering community has argued that QBS will actually help in this, and if we find out that's not the case, we need to hear that as quickly as possible, too.
Great, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, could we please bring up Robert DeCote, James Gambardella. And colleagues, just to give some background, Sal Khadri of ValueCAD suggested that these gentlemen come and talk about how small business work is being done at the federal level as well as in other states, and how we might be able to incent and do a better job supporting equal opportunity for minority women and emerging small businesses. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Shields and members of the committee, for giving us the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is James Gambardella. I'm with the Small Business Administration's Office of Government Contracting. Although I'm located physically in San Francisco, my office covers the 11 western states, including Oregon. And what we do is we administer the SBA's government contracting programs across the 11 western states. So, again, I'll start by answering the questions that were posed to us, and the first has to do is how the IDIQ process works for federal agencies with regard to A&E contracts. And generally, the process works as follows. Agencies will publicly announce A&E services requirements in the Federal Business Opportunities website. Prospective A&E firms will submit qualification statements, and I have an example of that that I can certainly leave for the committee's use to see what type of documentation that the firms have to submit. And then firms will be evaluated on things such as the professional licenses that they hold, any type of specialized experience and technical competence that they've demonstrated previously, capacity to accomplish the work within the required time frame, and past performance. And with past performance, we don't only look at government past performance on contract, on government contracts, we will look at private sector work as well. We also will examine, you know, the firm's physical location and their knowledge of the general geographic area and any other criteria deemed appropriate. And by that, usually like things like subcontracting or having relationships with other firms or in the industry partners that might be able to help or would be an asset to the firm should they be selected for one of these projects. The agencies will then conduct discussions with at least three of the most highly qualified firms, and then they'll develop this short list of those firms determined to be most highly technically qualified, and then those firms will be asked to submit technical packages and make oral presentations generally before an A&E board for the contracting agency that's requiring the A&E services. Then the firms will be ranked, and the top-ranked firms will be provided the solicitation, after which the government will conduct negotiations on terms and conditions, pricing, and other issues that might be pertinent to the particular contract. And then those successful firms will be awarded IDIQ-type contracts. And once that happens, then they will compete against one another for contract requirements as they come, they come about. Each firm is guaranteed a minimum fee, and it really is minimal. It's generally, you know, in the range of about $1,000 or a few thousand dollars. So each firm will get some funds, but however, it's still incumbent upon the firms to compete against one another for the contract opportunities as they go along. And I also have a sample of a synopsis notice, which is for an A&E IDIQ type contract, which pretty well describes what the situation is. And I've also brought along a copy of the FAR regulations with the policies and procedures applicable to the acquisition of A&E services, which I can also.
That's great. And we'll put all those into the record for the committee website.
Okay. So I'll move on to the next question. Of course, if there's any questions or anything, I'm more than happy to ask it at any point. And the second question we were asked to provide information on is, how do federal agencies determine how to set aside projects for small businesses? And how it works in the federal government is contracting officers are expected to conduct adequate market research prior to establishing an acquisition strategy. They're required to consider if there are small businesses with the capabilities, capacity, and competency to meet the government's requirements. And if, as a result of that market research, there's a reasonable expectation that at least two or more small businesses are likely to submit bids and proposals, each offering the products and services of an independent small business, and an award can be made at a fair and reasonable price, the expectation is that those requirements will be set aside for small business. And on the subject of market research, that can take many forms, but at a minimum, contracting officers are expected to review things like procurement history, search the system for award management, SAM, and the Small Business Administration's dynamic small business search databases to identify potential small businesses. They can also tap into the expertise of the SBA, particularly the Procurement Center representatives, PCRs as they're more commonly known, and these individuals are procurement professionals. They're assigned to major federal procuring activities throughout the country, and they work with the local buying office personnel to enhance the position of small business and assist them in effecting set-asides and maximizing small business participation in their overall procurements. Of course, we have excellent district office staff, such as Rob and his staff here in Portland, and they have a good knowledge of potential small business sources, including small disadvantaged businesses, who some of which are in SBA's 8A Business Development Program, women-owned small businesses, service-disabled, veteran-owned small businesses, and hub-zone firms. And they could particularly be effective because, again, they know the local terrain and what's available here, and they're particularly effective in helping federal buying offices and contracting officers to identify small business sources. For non-commercial requirements or requirements that might be a little bit off the beaten path, many contracting officers will issue sources sought notices in the Federal Business Opportunities website and require those firms to submit capability statements. And many times they'll even conduct industry days where the firms can come in, they have an opportunity to learn more about the government's requirements while at the same time meeting with the technical and contracting staff and providing them with additional information on their individual capabilities. So those are the most important ways that contracting officers can determine whether or not something is suitable for set-aside. And again, SBA is always standing there ready to be able to assist these contracting officers in identifying sources. Okay, and then the third question is, what parts of the FAR were for IDIQ and small business set-aside projects? And FAR subpart 16.5 handles the policies, rules, and regulations related to IDIQ type contracts, and I also brought a copy of those for the committee. And the FAR subpart 19.5 specifically talks about set asides, so, and I also brought a copy of that along.
Excellent. So.
Okay, ready to go? Yep. Okay, so the fourth question we had was, what role does SBA play to promote small businesses as well as minority and women and emerging small business firms? And SBA is the federal agency tasked to ensure that small businesses have the maximum practicable opportunity to compete for federal contracts, awards, and subcontracts. And as part of that role, each year the SBA negotiates contract goals with 24 major federal agencies, and we establish goals for small businesses, small disadvantaged businesses, women-owned small businesses, service-disabled veteran-owned small businesses, and firms that are in the SBA's Hub Zone program. Throughout the year, we monitor and work with those agencies to ensure that they're making progress and they're on track towards meeting their respective goals, and if not, we expect them to give us corrective action plans, where they describe what they're going to do to make their best efforts in order to be able to meet those goals. Now, again, the goals are largely aspirational, but again, what we stress when we're dealing with the contracting agencies that the goals are a floor, not a ceiling. So we're expecting agencies to exceed those goals, and that's the expectations that the administration has for the agencies as well. And then at the end of the year, SBA issues a report card, and it's publicly available on our website, and we grade agencies on a scale of A to F depending upon how effective their programs are and the efforts that they've made to try to meet their goals. And that's been very effective because, you know, no agency wants to be on the report card with an F for sure. Then SBA also goes beyond the agency-wide monitoring for small business goals, and we work with and monitor the efforts by individual contracting offices or buying offices through the Procurement Center representatives, whose role I described earlier. And we also have a cadre of professionals known as commercial marketing representatives, or CMRs, and they work with large business prime contractors to make sure that those firms are maximizing their efforts towards enhancing small business participation with subcontracts. And Some of the other things we do is, again, we obviously don't have personnel available to sit in each and every federal buying office or each and every large business prime contractor. So what we will do is we'll periodically do surveillance reviews and compliance reviews of those buying offices or large prime contractors where we don't have necessarily a regular presence or relationship. And we'll go in and review their small business programs, and then we'll issue reports to them on ways that we think that they can develop or that they can enhance and improve their small business programs. SBA also conducts regular training for federal agency, large business prime personnel, as well as for small businesses on how to do business with the government. Our overall goal, obviously, is to create a favorable environment for small business at these buying activities, and also to create an awareness and understanding on the part of small businesses on what it takes to be a successful small business contractor. And again, I brought along some of the tools that were developed by my office and which we try to use out here when we counsel, train, and assist small businesses. Although I bring them in paper copy, actually it's better when we send them to people electronically, because all of the links, and there are hyperlinks, so people can just go in there, click on a link, get the information. And we've really found this effective, not only in educating small businesses in particular, but it saves us a lot of time, because before we had to sit down face-to-face with people or over a telephone and actually go through these steps one by one. Now we give it to them, and they can do it at their leisure or when it's convenient for them. So these have really been effective tools for us to get the word out to small businesses on what's necessary to be effective in the federal marketplace.
Great. And could you, we'll put those on the website, but also send us the electronic ones.
I sure
and
will.
We'll get that up there as well.
Okay. I'd be more than happy to do that. And then, of course, SBA has an extensive network of resource partners. We have small business development centers, women's business centers, veteran business opportunity centers, and procurement technical assistance centers, just to name a few. And they are there to assist small businesses, not only for their specific constituencies, but many of them will offer services well beyond that. And that's essential because, again, SBA can't be everywhere to assist every small business. So we rely heavily on our resource partners to assist us in getting the word out to small businesses and educating them on the finer points of doing business with the government. And perhaps most importantly, the most important thing in my view in government contracting is getting the commitment of not only the procurement people, but of the people who generate the requirements to be able to support small business. And to that end, the SBA is working very closely with the Federal Office of Federal Procurement Policy and the federal agencies to place performance goals in the plans of the employees tied to the small business participation. We believe that that's going to help in really motivating some contracting officials and some other employees, particularly on the technical side, to do bigger and better things for small business. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rob.
Can I ask you a question?
Oh, sure.
A question, and committee members, feel free as well. So we've heard it argued that the federal government will not allow certain state agencies that receive federal funds, for example, in transportation, to allow remuneration when services haven't been rendered. So you talked about people being given a minimum of, say, $1,000 just for essentially the cost of being ready. Is there, in your experience, do you think it would be possible for a state agency using federal highway dollars to do that, or federal agency to federal agency?
I think that would be allowable. Of course, that would be something, like, say, for highway funds to discuss with the Department of Transportation. But IDIQ contracts are really effective in that it's greater flexibility for the government agencies, particularly within regard to the federal government. Over the years, we've lost a lot of experienced contracting people, so we're doing more with less in that respect there. So by having these IDIQ contracts in place, particularly over, like, say, a 4 or 5 year period, have been beneficial because it eliminates a lot of the administrative functions and a lot of the the grunt work necessary in awarding contracts, to have that vehicle there, and you can just go ahead and essentially issue a requirement and get proposals back from the firms on the IDIQ type contract, and then evaluate them and make an award. It really streamlines the process and has really benefited agencies and the small businesses like it as well, because of the fact that it takes time and money to put together proposals. So even though they still have to put together a technical and cost proposal to get the IDIQ type contract, generally, that's the hard part. Now, yes, they do have to submit cost proposals for individual task orders, but generally it's a lot less of a burden on them than it would be if each of these requirements were solicited individually and they had to submit full proposals and have those evaluated and awards made that way there.
And so the federal government has small business set-asides that are hard goals.
Yes.
These are not aspirational.
Yeah.
And then the aspirational part comes in because of case law that says you can't do a set-aside for minorities unless there is a study indicating that there's been disparity.
Correct, yes. Well, we have an 8A business development program, and there are groups that are designated, and generally those are members of minority groups, but that is a business development program, but an important part of that program is a contracting component, and it has both a sole source and competitive contract aspect to that program.
And is there any reason why a state government couldn't create a small business set aside?
No. As far as not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, and I'm glad you jumped right in the middle of this, and we'll let the state director jump in too. But we've dabbled around the edges with preferential things, and I am really familiar with the 8A program.
Okay.
But could you expand a little bit on the ups and downs? And obviously, we don't have ANCs, Alaska Native Corporations, here in Oregon, but we do have Native American and women-owned 8As, and how that program works, because as you know, it's kind of a preferential program, and there are actually advantages similar to the IDIQ in which you can do sole source negotiations and so on and so forth like that, or competitively bid between those. And that's an area that this committee hasn't talked about it as 8A, but it's been talked about between the committee members. So if you could maybe take 2 or 3 minutes to explain the 8A program and its advantages, and there are disadvantages,
sure,
so that, you know, at the state level, we kind of understand that.
Well, again, it's important to understand that the 8A program is a business development program. It's not a contracting program. If it was a contracting program, it probably couldn't withstand constitutional scrutiny. So it is a business development program. Firms are enter the program. It's a 9-year term. They get developmental assistance and business assistance to try to develop their core organizations to make them more viable going forward. And part of that, again, is the contracting aspect of it. Now, ANCs, Native Americans, Native Hawaiian organizations, they are part of the designated group, so they are automatically considered eligible for the 8A program. So what they'll do is they will step, like the tribes or the ANCs or the NHOs will establish for-profit entities. And then those for-profit entities, because they're owned, operated, and controlled by those individuals, gain entry into the program, and then they can compete for contracts. And in a sense, sometimes the ANCs, NHOs, and Indian tribes have somewhat of a super preference because of the fact that there are certain contracts that they can get larger contracts on a sole source basis than the average small business concern can do. And obviously the reason why they're in this program and given that preference is because, again, the assumption is that the monies and the funds generated from those contracts are going to go back to the tribes and communities and help lift the economic experience for all of those. Now, and like I say, so the 8A program can be a real boon or a real opportunity, because It's not a handout, but it is a hand up, and it allows small businesses, particularly socially and economic, owned by socially and economically disadvantaged individuals, an opportunity to compete in the marketplace. It levels the playing field, so if they are competing, they're only competing with firms that are similarly situated. And obviously, again, at the end of their term, the hope is that these firms go on and are successful in and of themselves. The disadvantage is that there are some that view 8A as somehow in inferior. So so, like, part of what we do is going out there and advocating and demonstrating how this program is beneficial, not only to the businesses and the individuals, but to the government. Because, like, Rob and I were speaking earlier, and I said it's my experience is that some contracting officers hate the 8A program until they find that 8A firm that they fall in love with. And then what they want to do is, you know, there'll be an IT services firm, and they'll say, well, we want to give them janitorial services. And we'll say, well, wait, but they're not really. But they'll say, but it's janitorial services for an IT facility, so, you know, that's it there. So obviously our challenge at that point in time is to say, look, there's more than one good firm in this program. There's lots of good firms in this program. And if you give these firms a chance, they can demonstrate to you that they could provide quality services, competitive prices, and perform just as good, if not better, than a large business. And not only that, generally the chief executive officer is only a phone call away. Try getting the hold of a chief executive officer of a large business. It's probably virtually impossible. So we really believe that this program does achieve its mission and assists minority and economically disadvantaged businesses to be able to compete in the federal marketplace.
Mr. I need to follow up because I'd like him to comment so the committee members hear this. And that one of the aspects of the 8A firm, and we've looked at design-build as ways to save money, and if you're in smaller categories in this area that we're tasked in this committee, small business, to do, is that they can come in, as you said, janitorial firm. There might be one that's doing small janitorial firm service in which the state, as the contractor, can go to the 8A, and they don't have to write a separate statement of work. They don't have to negotiate it. They don't have to competitively bid it. They sit down and they can negotiate. Unlike, okay, Senator Shields, how much is it going to cost me? And Senator Rosenbaum, and they make this proposal, the contracting officer can go back and forth and say, look, no, the market rate is this. We need to get this service in the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And so it provides those minority firms that we have in Oregon that are disadvantaged at state level, because we don't have like an 8A program, in which the government gets a really good deal. It streamlines the whole thing, and then you don't get into all these huge contracting problems. Now, they're being nice, because on the flip side, there are some big mega ones out there that they act like the 800-pound gorillas, and their, quote, mentor protégés are 900-pound gorillas. So there are some, especially in Congress, some issues with the program. But from we've looked at the IDIQ point of view and how you do that and go forward. But, you know, like design build, as cuts come forth from the state budget, there are some opportunities in this area, in the 8A category, whether we piggyback and figure out how to piggyback on the federal government side or something to save money, to get good services, to help build minority and small businesses up and reduce our contracting costs the same way. Mm-hmm. Am I missing something here?
No, I agree.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, here in Oregon, when we ask a state agency, how are they doing on these issues, they report back minority women and emerging small business, and then you have to probe to say, well, how many of those are really minority businesses, and how does it break out? And then they say, well, we'll get back to you, and they usually do. But we might want to think about whether or not we want to try to do a small business set-aside kind of program, assuming that what you're saying is that would withstand legal scrutiny.
Yes. I mean, yeah, it's been long established that small business set-aside programs will withstand constitutional scrutiny, yes. Yeah.
Did you have a question, Jeff?
Oh, I was just going to make a comment about, I was looking at your resources for sure, and one of the issues I think that's really important to note for the committee is the surety bond guarantee program, because when you look at the list of these type of projects, one of the biggest barriers for women and you know, for small businesses in general, is just the liability issues. And I saw that you, that's a big, I think, benefit that you provide, because certainly for these types of projects, unless you're doing sort of public involvement, all of these are going to require a high level of liability insurance. And that's my experience has been that's one of the barriers, and that's often why these companies will sub to the larger firms. So they're also, you know, covered through their insurance. So I think this is really important for us to look at. I don't know if we can piggyback onto that type of program, because certainly I know when you're talking about engineering services, surveying, you know, anything that is involved liability, especially for working with municipalities, state agencies, whatever, that my experience is going to be a barrier. So I think that's a real benefit of your program that we need to look at.
Great. Robert, are you just here for?
I can do all that and then some. Mr.
Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Rob Ducote. So I'm the acting director for the Portland District, which covers Oregon and Southwest Washington. So glad to come here today. And Jim did a great job in kind of drawing you the pictures of what it's like to be on the contracting side of the fence for those in Oregon. I'm gonna add one comment on something on the contracting piece, and let's kind of color it for Oregon. Okay, when we talk about what we do here in the state from a federal procurement side, we hit roughly 40% of all the federal procurement dollars annually go to small businesses. That's not by accident. Okay, there is a strong network of contracting agencies here with relationships deep into their communities that look for those opportunities. First of all, there is the mandate of 23%, but Oregon hasn't been anywhere near 23% in years. Last year we were at 60. We're already over 40 this year, and we're not done. So, and I think when we look, if you break down those numbers, you know, we can actually look at those numbers in things like the federal procurement data system, where we can actually break it down by particular minority set. Mm-hmm. So we can actually look and see how someone's doing. I can see how many women-owned small businesses have been awarded federal contracts. I can see how many Asian Pacific, African American, 8A firms, service-disabled firms, veteran firms, all that's in there. So as we, you know, talk about building this future at the state level, that type of data system would be important if you really want to get into who's actually getting the dollars across the board. It actually is a good way to judge and measure the effectiveness of that system. And it's doable here at the state level if you really want to do it. But know that the partners here in Oregon from the federal level, they're very active. Already about $400 million has already gone into small businesses' hands through federal procurement dollars. We average over $500 million every year. So that's a significant amount of dollars that are going out there. We talk about 8A. There's 46 firms. Now, if you were to ask me what I think the weaknesses and the Achilles heels are, is it's a promotional problem. Okay, there are a lot more firms that are eligible for the 8A program, which is an economically and socially disadvantaged business development program, than 46. There's only 197 certified hub zone firms, and hub zone is a set-aside category. So there's a lot more firms than just 197 firms in the state of Oregon that have their businesses in a hub zone, in a designated hub zone. So we recognize this at the federal level, and how we try to address it is through marketing and outreach to the communities. The businesses have to see the value of signing up for those certification programs, and those certification programs should have goals, like ours do, in order for them to be successful. So it's not just setting the agency or mandating that you have to go do it. We have to flip on the other side to the cultural piece, not only on the contractor side, but on the community side, and get folks to come in and join it. Because my numbers here at the federal level would be even higher if I could get more people in those buckets and more people where they could be selected for small business contracting. But we do a pretty good job overall.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a question? So to take advantage of the small business set-asides, you have to be certified.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, there are two forms. There's usually, you can be a self, some forms or some certifications are self-certifications. Others have require a more formalized certification, such as the 8A program.
Right. We have two formal certification programs, our 8A business development program and our hub zone program. And then we have another which is more like a documented self-certification program, and that's for women-owned and economically disadvantaged women-owned small businesses. For a generic small business, so to speak, that's a self-certification process. Now, SBA polices that process, because if we get a credible protest or we believe that a firm is abusing that they're claiming that they're small and they're not small, we will do a formal size determination on that firm where we go in and really do a thorough investigation to determine what their real size is. And there are repercussions and penalties for firms that knowingly misrepresent themselves as being small businesses or any of the other subcategories. And that's an important part of the process as well, so that this way there are consequences for people bad actors who try to abuse the or take advantage of something that they're really not entitled to.
Senator Boquist. Two questions. One's first a quick one. Is the 8A, does the Oregon approve it, or is it approved out of the Seattle office? Issue. Okay. The second question I have
When you say approval, they start with us, but they actually go back to a headquarters organization inside NSBA for formal acceptance into the program, but they come through the districts.
Okay. Second question I have, and you might not know the answer to this, looking at how you would structure something at the state level, which if the state adopted some program, and maybe you know it somewhere elsewhere in the United States, that said if you're federally recognized in HUB Zone or 8A or one of these, so on and so forth, the state had a law that said if you federally recognize these programs, then XYZ we can do at the state. Do you know of any other states that do that, or do they do independent programs? Or in these cost-saving days, it's hard for us to set up our own program, but I know there's no liability, but I don't know how other states might possibly do it.
Most states have their own systems, their own programs for things like that. Some of them will rely heavily on the federal certifications and things like that, but generally they do have their own process to claim that designation, like say if they're doing business with a state government. Now I do know that the Department of Transportation will accept some states' minority and women-owned business enterprise certifications for those type projects, but in overall government contracting, even if you have a state certification, you still have to apply and be certified by the federal government. In the 8A program, for example, mm-hmm. with the Small Business Administration, our Hub Zone program, same thing. Veterans Administration handles a lot of obviously veteran and service disabled mm-hmm. veteran-owned small business certification type efforts.
Thank you.
If I can add one comment, Chairman.
Yes.
If in this area, especially for our state, if we have with such an active federal presence with procurement dollars in these programs, mm-hmm. if Oregon decides to pursue that path, to keep it simple, one of the things we hear often from small businesses is it's too complex and we don't know where to go or know what the rules are. If we're going to work on something like this, probably looking at the federal regulations and working together to make sure that at least if they're already in one or they're looking at a set of standards in one, they kind of mirror each other mm-hmm. so that we're not asking for two completely different sets of things. Might be from a small business owner's perspective, since we talk to them all the time, might make it helpful for them.
That's exactly my point.
Right.
We all got to start working together because things after sequestration are going to get real interesting.
Right. Yeah, no, this is tremendously helpful, gentlemen. Robert, could you get us the committee or to the professional staff the list of who those 46 8A firms are
mm-hmm.
in the
sure.
Oregon area? And two, I was wondering if it's possible for you to break down in the region or in Oregon the number of firms that have received IDIQ contracts or price agreement kinds of contracts that were small businesses.
They might be able to do that.
Just so that we can try to compare how IDIQ contracts are working here versus how they're working at the federal level, if you have that available.
Okay, I'll see if
they aren't working here. That's why we're having these hearings. That's why we're looking for them for help.
Right. Well, if we could see that small business is getting it at the federal level, that would help.
All right.
Sorry, it's whatever you got. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for having
and
us.
And look forward to working with you to see if we can get the systems to work in sync with each other. Could we please bring up Rob Bruce and Willie Davis? Thanks for hanging in there, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman Shields, the committee, I am Willie Davis, Jr. I appreciate the time you have given to for me to express my experience as a small business minority contractor in the state of Oregon. First of all, I'd like to express a great deal of appreciation. I guess I would say I'll be proud to be a graduate of the 8A program under the SBA. That was a program that gave a great deal of support. I could go into some of the aspects of what the gentleman that represented the SBA has spoke of, but I would just like to add on that along with what the services that they provide, the training, the workshops, the individual support, it was really important how the SBA build relationships with the participants that were involved. my experience has been working with what they call the bosses has been very positive. They gave a great deal of support. I was certified back in 2002. And at that time, we had a great deal of staff and support to spread around. But as time went on, and I graduated just last year in 2011, there was very little staff. But the SBA had worked out ways and strategies and methods to where they still gave a great deal of support. And I keep wanting to emphasize the biggest aspects was the relationships. One can talk about relationships, but it's how relationships are developed that will assist businesses and help them to be successful. My experience currently now working a great deal with the federal agencies such as the Forest Service, Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Land Management, I've experienced a great deal of working under IDIQ contracts. I currently have three IDIQ contracts. I also have been involved in design build, and I'm currently involved with the Corps of Engineers with a design build type contract. There again, I think it still comes back to the SBA, the support and the relationships that has been established with my company, and for the fact that I've obtained these IDIQ contracts during my 8A process and also after I graduated. These contracts are quite important. I think they're needed within the state level. And I just want to mention also, I think I just established a IDIQ contract with the City of Salem. The Public Works Department is working with me on a project. With that IDIQ contract, I have learned that for the federal government, there is a lot more savings when an IDIQ contract is established. There's been two types of IDIQ contract that I work on currently. BLM has what they call like a sole source IDIQ contract. This is where they will have projects and they will have a list of projects and they streamline them directly to me and I go out and perform the work. With the Forest Service, their IDIQ contract is that they will have a group of five contractors that will come in and basically compete against each other. But also, the Forest Service has adapted that they look to try to spread those contracts out. They will look at individual contractor. If he had one or two contracts, they will look to other contractors to try to perform that work. Again, I think it's coming back to relationships and how they build those relationships and how they're trying to spread out the aspect of that work. One other aspect I just would like to point out is within those contracts, the IDIQ contracts, I think it was quite helpful when we had bad economical times and the Recovery Act came into play. With those IDIQ contracts and with the support of the SBA and also the 8A program, the federal government was able to try to get that money dispersed out into the communities faster. Through my company, not only did it help support other small businesses, but it also helped to support large businesses. Because once those funds came out, it was presented to me, can I get other firms involved, not just trying to take on the task myself? They're wanting me to look at funds to be able to spread out to other small businesses and also large firms that have the capabilities. I thought that was very important because then it doesn't necessarily build up a negative relationship or a negative response towards the 8A program or minority contractors. Because the larger firms are looking at, gosh, I can work with this minority firm, this minority firm has expertise, and they're bringing me work instead of trying to keep it within the minority community or keeping it within small businesses. A number of the large firms I have built good relationships with. I even have built what you call teaming agreements, such as Knife River, such as Salem Road and Driveway, Riverbend, Eugene Sand and Gravel in Lane County. These businesses call me at times now to say, Willie, you have something coming up. Is there some projects that we need to give you assistance on? To me, gentlemen and ladies, Chairman Shields, I thought that was very important because I'm not only building a network with the small businesses, I'm also building a network with all businesses throughout the state of Oregon.
That's interesting. So rather than you always calling on them saying, hey, can I have some work, and them saying no, they're actually having, they're calling you and saying, hey, do you need our services?
Yes.
Interesting. Questions?
I'll wait till the next presenter's done. I have a...
Rob, welcome to the committee.
Morning, Chairman Shields, members of the committee. My name is Rob Bruce, Sandy River Construction Services. Really, a lot has been said, especially to gentlemen from the SBA. I think they really outlined in time allowed how well a program like this can work. When Mr. Winkles was talking, I just heard a couple of things that he said, and this is what I'd like to overcome, whether it's through legislation or sitting down at a table and negotiating. You know, yes, he made the statement, well, we put in all of our RFPs that there's no guarantee of work. Well, that's kind of a moot point because we all somewhat know that already, but it does have to be in there. He stated that there's not enough work to go around. Well, if you know that, don't issue the IDIQ. I mean, it still doesn't make any sense. I'm going to bring this back a year and a half or 2 years ago when we started. We're just asking these local government agencies to take, is this realistic? Why should we put this RFP out? Is there money there? Don't just throw out an RFP because you did it 2 years ago too. I mean, you got to put some common sense into play here. With what the SBA has done, I mean, they've got the proven track record. The SBA didn't get as big as it did because it was a failure. The SBA is obviously a huge organization. Small businesses grow economies, big businesses don't. I've firsthand watched Willie grow his business over the course of the last few years. It's been quite a thing to watch. He's built a great reputation. And when he's talking about not going to just minorities, sometimes I actually work on some of Willie's bids. I'm going to sub-suppliers, all kinds of different, depending on what the job is. They're usually not minority. They're big corporations, Knife River. I mean, how much rock have you bought from Knife River in the last 2 years? A lot. Senator Shields, I heard you made a comment that if we can keep this out of legislation, I'm for that. I'm going to sit down and talk at a table. But there's a vast, vast room for improvement. There's just no need. You know, I didn't bring my old notes, but in the beginning, when I stated it costs maybe $5,000, $6,000 for a small company to write an RFP and do that 3-4 times a year, and then you take 30 or 40 companies that are doing that, you know, simple math, how much that money is being wasted. This economy doesn't stand for money to be wasted. So, you know, asking cities to project, look out, say, hey, we've got this budget. Keep it simple math. If we've got a $1,000 budget, why are we looking for $5,000 in IDIQ contracts? It's not going to happen. Just stop and take a look. You're saving everybody time. You're saving everybody money. And in the interest of time, I'm going to kind of keep it short. So I think that's about all. The only other note I had made listening to everybody testify was, maybe I can head up putting together a volunteer team to go work with local agencies, government agencies, and help them identify these areas. You know, if it saves everybody time, streamlines the process, opens new doors, builds new relationships, why not? Let's find a way to make it work. That's all I got.
Senator Boquist.
two quick questions, and I think one's a question and one's get Willie to expand a little bit on it so the committee, I think, understands. Were you part of the Mentor Protege program or just straight A? Or?
I was pretty much, excuse me, Senator Shields committee. I was part of the 8A program, but I also mentored other 8A participants. Basically, not to make it official, but to give them support. Mm-hmm. This is also recommendations from the federal agencies, and they pretty much had asked, hey, Willie, can you help support this new 8A contractor coming into the program? And I did.
Second question, follow-up here, and trying to get to the, I guess the committee can kind of understand. You made mentions, like, Forest Service was, you know, competitively bid the IDIQ, and I'm assuming it's under a task order procedure.
Yes.
And maybe you can just explain to the committee so that they understand that, you know, when these task orders, they're really streamlined, at least the ones I've been experienced with, but how, you know, you didn't have to go out and recompete the whole thing, but what was that process? Did the agency contact you and send you a short statement of work and you submitted something quickly, or was it weeks and weeks and weeks, or?
Very efficient.
Senator Shields, Senator, that was definitely streamlined. Over the years, the SBA and also BLM, I feel like they have perfected it a little bit more to where there's less time. At this point, what the Forest Service does is that they identify a task of work that needs to be done. A lot of the Forest Services is drainage, road work, taking care of the forts. So they will have the IDIQ contract bid schedule identify, and the contractor will apply numbers to that. If the IDIQ is 2 to 3 years, they will identify the cost of inflation. And then at that time, when a task order needs to be issued, they don't have to go through the process of getting a bid from the contractor. The contractor's already identified his numbers. They call the contractor up. Here's the amount of the task order. When can you start the work? This has been streamlined so quickly now that a task order can be issued and a contractor can start work within 3 to 5 days.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Did you want to come up and?
Just
wait till you get to the chair and
Chairman,
you can, yes,
members of the committee.
Just be sure to identify yourself for the record.
I will. This is Rob Ducote, the acting director for the SBA for the Portland District, which is Oregon and Southwest Washington. To address specifically, Senator, your question, and one thing I'd like to offer the committee is that Willie has spoken very well about the nuances of the 8A program, and we're getting to some of the details on how do we actually push these contracts quickly. He's correct that it is a streamlined process, and we would be happy if at some future point, if you want us to bring one of our 8A folks in that manages the program, to bring them to you, and we can give you a short discussion on, you know, what the nuances of the 8A program are in terms of how it's actually executed. It might be beneficial for you to understand some of the details on how we do it.
Okay.
So just want to make sure we offer that to you as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We are almost back on track time-wise. So, gentlemen, thank you very much. One last question, Mr. Davis. I think they're at ODOT, they've created a mentor protege program in construction. Have you or anybody you've known participated in that?
Yes, I'm currently involved in what they call a small contracting program with ODOT. I have performed work for ODOT in the past, but it seems like those type of programs have been a little slow in developing. I wish there was more effort, more time put towards ODOT's ability to work with minority contractors, small businesses. Hopefully in the future that will improve.
Yeah. Well, this is all very good information. I think if we have something that's working at the federal level, we should pay very close attention to that and not try to recreate the wheel, as Senator Dingfelder said in the note to me. So thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming. And we'll move on to the next agenda item.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jim. Mr. Chair, I appreciate you doing this. I've been beating up on this, what the feds do and how well their program works compared to what we do the state, I think, for 2 years now.
Yeah, good. All right, we move on to the next agenda item, medical self-referral practices. Could we please bring up Chris Altenhoffen and Diana Goodwin? And just to tee this up, colleagues, Chris gave some testimony before in the healthcare committee that I felt was appropriate for a small business protection issue that comes under the auspices of our committee. So I invited him to come, and Diana, we've heard similar concerns about those in the physical therapy community, and so I wanted to make sure that your legislature heard from you.
Thank you.
Chairman Shields and committee members, thank you for inviting me here. My name is Chris Altenhofen. I am a radiologist in Portland, Oregon, and you know, I know time is short, so I'm going to sort of cut to the chase here. We're going to discuss the issue of self-referral in medicine in general. I will specifically speak about self-referral in the medical imaging market as I've seen it evolve over the last 10 to 12 years in Portland. I work for an independent radiology group. We have three outpatient imaging centers in Portland. When I talk about self-referral, I'm talking about the situation that arises when private physician practices, treating physicians, either single physicians or groups of physicians, purchase their own imaging equipment and then refer their patients that they see to their own equipment, and then they can bill for that and collect the reimbursement for that. And that really creates a conflict of interest for the physicians' groups. They have to balance the financial gain they can get from ordering more and more exams versus what the patient's real needs are. That's different from the situation that I am in, where we have an independent group. We aren't the treating physicians. We have to compete in the marketplace to attract physicians to refer patients to us. Separately, we cannot order our own examinations, so we don't have that same sort of conflict of interest of self-referral. So basically, what it does, you know, I did mention the conflict of interest that it puts the referring physician in. It has been shown to increase utilization rates for medical imaging. In fact, all of the increased utilization in imaging has occurred in the self-referral setting and not in the independent radiology practices over the past 10 years. And I refer you to the information I provided for the committee previously. Anecdotally, the reviews have shown that utilization rates can go up from 50% and in some instances up to 700%. So you can see dramatic increases in utilization rates when the treating physicians own their own imaging equipment. And another meta-analysis did show that this costs Medicare billions of dollars a year. It's also a patient safety issue, because if we're talking about CT examinations, there may be unnecessary CT examinations exposing the patient to unnecessary radiation. It's also results in a diminished quality of exams. If a referring physician group can buy a cheap CT scanner, still refer patients to it, do the same type of examination with lower quality and output, the incentive, financial incentive for them is to do that, to minimize their expenditures on capital equipment costs, because they get paid the same no matter what they do. If it's a 0.2 Tesla MR versus a 3 Tesla like we have, the reimbursement is the same. There's no differentiation for it. So they don't have to spend a bunch of money on their equipment because they're not competing in the broader market to attract patients and referrers to their center. And I, again, referring to those same materials I submitted, 78% of non-radiologist imaging providers had serious deficiencies in their staff or equipment. And, of course, the patients don't know the difference of what they're getting. They don't know if they're getting a high-quality MRI or not. In their minds, they're getting an MRI, and an MRI is the same. And, the reimbursement is the same. Again, it's anti-competitive. It's what you're doing is you're carving out pieces of the patient population and separating it into these practice groups. And for us, as an independent radiology practice, we see, you know, the broader market getting carved up more and more, whether it be by hospital systems that will be talked about or these other independent groups with their own self-referral imaging equipment. So for us, we see our market sorely being encroached upon, and it's getting harder and harder for us to survive. My practice has been around for 50 years. We've been an entrepreneurial practice, bringing an innovator, bringing new equipment and new modalities to the Portland area, and in fact, the whole region, well ahead of the curve. We brought in digital mammography, PET CT, virtual colonoscopy, well before anybody else was doing it, and we did it consistently with high quality, the highest quality, and for the lowest cost by far in the region. I mean, that is just a success story of entrepreneurship, but this is all being threatened by the current structural changes that are taking place in the market, including this self-referral. So there are some regulations against self-referral already. The federal Stark laws are in place. They refer to federal payers. The problem with the Stark laws is there's this big gaping hole in it called the in-office ancillary exception, where it doesn't prevent groups from putting their own imaging equipment in and self-referring, because there's this exception there. It was put in place when it was created in the early 90s because CT, MR, and PET CT hadn't really gained a lot of traction yet. It referred mostly to x-ray machines and ultrasound machines, relatively less sophisticated exams that don't reimburse as much, and that incentive for overutilization is not as great. Since then, however, CT, MR, and PET CT have blossomed, and they're widely used, and those are the modalities that we're really addressing here. Furthermore, most other states have enacted their own self-referral laws, and I did send out some material on that also, outlining state by state which states have regulation in place. Oregon is in the minority there in not having any self-referral laws in place. And, you know, Oregon is priding itself on being a leader in the healthcare arena. And Governor Kitzhaber, I think, was ranked number third most influential politician in the country. Yet Oregon is well behind the curve on this issue that's driving, is a significant driver for healthcare costs. So I did submit to you also a draft bill that had been drawn up 18 months ago, 2 years ago. It didn't make it through committee. But it is modeled after Maryland's self-referral law, which is considered the model of self-referral laws in the country. It does address primarily CT, MRI, and PET CT. It does allow x-ray and ultrasound in referring offices. But I would urge you to take a look at that, review it. Again, it is kind of the model self-referral law in the country. It's been in place for 10 years. It was challenged all the way up to the Maryland Supreme Court, and they upheld the law. The only other comment that I'll make is that with the current health care reform coming into place, they are going to start diminishing reimbursements for equipment that isn't fully utilized. So you will have to have, to get full reimbursements, you'll need utilization rates of 90% on your equipment. That means if you only use your equipment 50% of the time, you're going to get a lower reimbursement rate. For us, there's not much we can do about that. We can't demand that more patients be sent to us. In the self-referral setting, however, it's easy to make sure that you have 90% utilization rates in order to maximize your reimbursement. So it's a, you know, it's a classic example of an unintended consequence if you don't have some sort of restriction on self-referral.
Go ahead, and then we'll ask some questions.
Thank you, Chairman Shields, members of the committee. I'm Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Oregon. And in my private practice, I represent approximately 165 private practice, independently owned physical therapy clinics. I also am a member of the bar in the state of Washington. And there, I represent about 185 private practice physical therapy clinics. I have represented this group of medical clinics now for probably some 25 years. And I can
can tell you that one of the major concerns our independent practice physical therapy clinics are seeing is the increase in physician-owned physical therapy services, and in particular, what I wanted to talk to you today about is corporate-owned medical systems that employ the doctors and require the doctors to refer physical therapy patients to the corporate-owned physical therapy clinics. And the concerns about this are, number one, it harms your independent practice small businesses, but number two, it increases utilization. The rates charged are much higher, and also we believe it impairs the independent judgment of the physical therapist employee of the corporation where the physician in the corporation is required to refer to that corporate-owned physical therapy practice. I've submitted two pieces of written testimony today. First is my own testimony, but the second document that I've submitted to you is a summary of Chapter 8 of the MedPAC report to Congress. You're all familiar with MedPAC, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission that advises Congress on Medicare issues. In their June 15, 2010 report, which was like that, 300 pages, Chapter 8 dealt with this very issue of concerns about incentives in or addressing the growth of ancillary services in physicians' offices. Dr. Altenhofen addressed that exception under the Stark Law that was put into place in the 1990s, the in-office ancillary service exception that we are now seeing has resulted in physicians hiring more and more physical therapy clinics or corporate medical systems, opening their own private their own physical therapy systems and referring more and more to them. And Medicare and Congress is getting increasingly concerned about this, and I summarized that 30 pages of that Chapter 8 MedPAC report about the concern. And they have noted that the volume of outpatient therapy services provided by physicians or systems with a financial interest in those services rose by an average of 11.4% per beneficiary per year. By comparison, all physician services grew by 4.6%. They're raising increasing concerns about overutilization, over-referral, lack of independent judgment by the physical therapists if they're controlled by corporate interests. And in my testimony, I've given you some specific examples of what has happened to patients. As I said, I represent 165 clinics throughout the state. They contact me all the time. I mean, that's what I do. And they let me know when they've heard from patients about what's happening to them, about one patient seeing a specialist for care of her back problem. The physician was employed by a large healthcare corporation, although the physician had no direct financial interest in the physical therapy services. In other words, he wasn't earning more money by referring more patients. But the physician is required to refer, quote, in-house. And the patient ordered physical therapy for this patient, and the patient was offered a direct appointment with one of the corporate clinics. She declined, said she'd like to make the appointment with a physical therapist she'd used in the past and in whom she had confidence and who knew her musculoskeletal challenges. The physician stated that she had to pick a PT clinic from the list of corporate-owned clinics, and so that was direct pressure or indirect pressure on her. She acceded to that. More direct pressure, we had a situation where a patient argued and argued with the physician, did come to the independent practice PT clinic, learned that she did have a right to choose her own physical therapy clinic, but the doctor learned about it and made such a fuss that she had to go back to a corporate clinic. We've had physicians tell patients, if you don't accept the referral to the corporate-owned clinic, we will not write you a prescription for physical therapy. And so what we're seeing is the best interests of the patient are not being served in these situations, and there is no curb on it. Right now, as we said, the start exception has the Stark Law has this enormous in-office ancillary service exception, big enough to drive a truck through, which they're doing. So you know we're going to need to look to the state to help us on this, particularly if we're looking at trying to control the cost of health care. Get a handle on this. This is a situation that results in higher costs, higher utilization. You know, as Dr. Einhofer testified to, duplicative services, duplicative tests, unnecessary, interferes with the independent medical practitioner judgment. And we would urge you to give Oregonians who need health care the same rights as Oregonians who need car repair have, which is they can take their car to any independent repair shop that they want. And they know about that. That right is not accorded to Oregon medical patients. And they should, at a minimum, be told that they have a right, which they do have a right to choice. Now, their insurance may require them to pay a larger copay or co-insurance amount, okay. But they need to be told they have a right to choose a medical practitioner of their choosing, as I said, subject to insurance payments. But that is not happening. The physicians are not telling patients that the physician has a financial interest. They're not telling patients that they're an employee of a corporation that owns the physical therapy clinic. At a minimum, we ought to be informing our consumers. We want our consumers to make more cost-effective choices and take responsibility to work with their independent practitioner for their health care. That's not happening. So with my written testimony, I know we're past time. I'd be happy to answer questions along with Chris.
Alex. Senator George.
Doctor, I actually, you said something that kind of caught me really odd. You said that they're encroaching on your market, and it's actually the opposite. What's happening, as I understand it, is that you're being eliminated from the market. So you have a superior product at a lower cost that the consumer is not gaining access to, and you're being eliminated from the market. So it's not like you have a market and they're eating your market share with a superior product at a lower cost. What's happening is you're providing a superior product at a lower cost, and you're being eliminated from that market segment. I mean, I think that's a really important distinction here.
I wouldn't argue with that. Yeah.
I would agree.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, those patients are taken out of the marketplace for us. We no longer have access.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess my Senator point is that both of these witnesses hit on something that's really important here, which is that we just are not allowing people to enter the free market system to get a superior product at a cheaper price. And somehow, we've got to figure out a way. This is not a regulatory thing. This is an anti-monopoly thing. This is more of an antitrust issue. And I really think that we need to couch it that way, because this is one of these things where we really need to give people access to those choices, and how we do that is going to be couched as being regulatory, and it's not. What it is it's breaking monopolistic tendencies within the healthcare field. So I appreciate both of your testimonies today.
I'll make one more comment, and that's, you know, I touched on it before. You know, we have been a leader of innovation and bringing new technology. We've done it well. We've done it for a low cost, lower than other centers provide routine care. And as we've watched things evolve over the last 10 years, you know, our business has high capital equipment costs. You know, it costs us $1.5 million to buy an MRI scanner, and then the service contract on that is $100,000 a year. I mean, we're talking a lot of money. And it's not easy then to go into a new area, take some risk, not guaranteed it's going to pay off. When we see the market shrinking from us, and you know, we're becoming restricted on being innovative, and I think that's a bad thing. I think it's unfortunate for the area, because we want to do new things, and innovation is good. It does a lot for the patient. You know, when we brought PET CT to the Portland area 12 years ago, we were criticized for it. And now it's a routine part of oncology imaging, and we're still willing to do it. We'll do it with virtual colonoscopy. We need to get paid for it by the federal payers, for one, but we're ready to do it. But we won't have the referrals if you know, we're restricted from the market.
The problem is physicians are restricting their patients, saying the patients have to receive their services, you know, from a physician-owned or corporate-owned practice, and patients don't usually have the wherewithal to resist their physician. It's a problem.
Senator Rosema.
Mr. Chair, I don't really want to open this can of worms at this late hour, but it seems like the state's trend toward coordinated care organizations and integrating all healthcare services into a unified system is kind of run counter to what you're asking for anyway. And I mean, that does seem to be the direction that we're heading. I don't know whether you think that's going to make things better or worse, but
I agree. It's a brave new world.
It is a brave new world. You know, there has been an impetus a little bit to funnel things towards the hospitals and into big, you know, integrated delivery systems.
Corporate health care.
Right. Which, to my mind, means a lot of hospital systems and a lot of hospital-based care. This is from the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago. Same doctor visit, double the cost. What happens when hospitals buy physician groups? Is what happens is they get paid on the hospital fee schedule and not the outpatient fee schedule, and the cost of their visit doubles. We get paid 25 to 30% less for the same MRI that is done in the hospital or at the hospital's outpatient clinic, five blocks away from us. We get paid less. And so, you know, I look at, I understand what you're saying, and I look at what you're, what's happening, but in a, it, to my mind, and I'm watching it, you know, from the inside, this, all of this doesn't make sense sometimes. And we're part of CCOs now, and, but it's unclear exactly how we're getting, how ancillary services will be paid within a CCO. Will we get paid on a per-click basis, a per-fee basis, which so far is the same as is what's happening, or will we somehow be incorporated into a sort of a, you know, a bundled sort of payment? So you're right. Those are unanswered questions. But for right now, from our standpoint, we're still getting paid on a fee-for-service even by within the CCO.
And I think you're right. I mean, some people will argue that you're going against the grain because we're moving towards this, towards payment reform. But my experience tells me that this is not going to happen in the next 5 years.
Right.
And it remains to be seen how exactly it's all going to play out. I do think what I've learned in this business is that rarely two sides come up and compete with varying ideas, and the best idea wins. It's usually a negotiated settlement. So if you all are thinking of looking at how to improve this system, I would encourage the other players to get together with you and see if there's a way that your needs could be met in ways that the other parties that have interests could tolerate. But I think what you're hearing from this committee is that we're all interested in helping move this along. So to the degree that other parties are listening to us, I think your arguments have been received favorably. And if there's a way that compromise could be struck to make everybody happy, I would encourage us to all do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I would say momentum's on your side coming to this next session. So let's try to do something with that. I think you've made a compelling case. Let's try to move forward with it.
So. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for coming. With no other business before the committee, Jen, anything else?
Nothing.
And this committee is adjourned.